Welcome to Time Traveling Team, the weekly podcast where we review every story of Doctor Who right from the very beginning. I'm Paddy.
And I'm Trisha. This week we join the Doctor, Nyssa, Tegan, and new companion Turlough as they find themselves fighting for Nyssa's life in Terminus. As usual, we'll be discussing the Doctor, companions, and villains and giving our thoughts on the story as a whole.
We'd also love to hear your thoughts on this story, so in order to join in the discussion, you can check us out at Time Team. That's TIME. TEAMP on Facebook, X/Twitter, and Instagram, or you can email us at timetravelingteam@teamproductions.com.
Okay, so before you go into the story summary, right?
Yes.
I need to say something up front.
Right.
I don't want to spoil it in case people haven't seen the story and they want to listen to Paddy's summary to find out what's happening. How this story ends, I didn't know that was the story.
Right.
Because I did my trivia after.
Mm-hmm.
So I was completely taken by surprise by how it ended. And while it's not the same thing, last week's X-Men, is still in my head. So I was what? What's happening? No. We can get to that when we get to discussion, but I need to say that up front. Just because.
Yeah. Oh, and yes, for those of our listeners, if you're interested, definitely recommend checking out X-Men 97.
It's so good. Did you watch this week's episode?
Not yet. I'm saving it for after recording.
I watched it at lunch. It's very good.
Very good. Nice.
Yeah. Okay, but this isn't about X-Men. This isn't about X-Men. It isn't about MASH. It isn't about X-Men. No.
Yeah.
This is about Doctor Who.
Doctor Who.
So, Paddy, if you would, please, sir, give us the story recap.
Absolutely. Part 1. Inside the TARDIS, Turlough explores the inner corridors as he communes with the Black Guardian, saying that he doesn't think Tegan and Nyssa trust him. The Black Guardian ignores his worries and instead instructs him on how to sabotage the ship. However, before he can do anything, he hears Tegan calling for him. She appears a few moments later and demands to know what he was doing, telling him that she thinks he is up to something. She examines a partially exposed wall panel and again demands to know what he is up to, but he says that she is being paranoid. She tells him that she doesn't trust his smooth-talking demeanor, but he says that she can't mistrust him simply because they have different personalities. They bicker back and forth, with Turlough saying that Tegan must learn to accept that her way of doing things isn't the only way. She says that she will tell the Doctor about the wall panel, but Turlough asks why he would put the ship at risk while he is on it. Seeing his point, Tegan reluctantly takes him to his new room, which she reveals was Adric's old room. Turlough expresses his distaste at the decor, and Tegan leaves, taking a memento from the Kinda planet with her. However, a few moments after she leaves, Turlough leaves and makes his way to the console room. Tegan goes to visit Nyssa in her room, where she is doing an experiment, and expresses her frustration with Turlough. She then asks about the experiment Nyssa is working on, and Nyssa replies that it is difficult without Adric to help her with the calculations. Tegan says that she will go back to his room to get Adric's notes before Turlough throws them out. However, when she gets back to his room, she finds him missing. Suddenly, a strange hazy mist appears in the corridors, which unbeknownst to her is a result of Turlough's tampering with the core of the TARDIS control console. She calls out for the Doctor, who comes running down the corridor to her. He sees the mist and says they need to get to the console room. They arrive there just after Turlough finishes his sabotage, which has caused the central rotor to jam. Turlough asks if Nyssa is safe, and the Doctor says he will refocus the external view screen. The screen shows that the mist has penetrated Nyssa's room, and the Doctor tells her to stay back from it. Suddenly, Tegan brings her attention to something forming in the mist, and they see a giant skull. Nyssa's experiments start to blow up, and the skull sears itself into the wall, which suddenly forms a doorway. The Doctor tells Nyssa to go through it, as it is the only way to avoid the mist. Nyssa cautiously goes through the door and finds herself in the hallway of another spaceship. They see the door begin to close after her, and the Doctor rushes to Nyssa's room and manages to jam it open. He then explains to a confused Tegan that the TARDIS was breaking apart, and as a failsafe, the ship locates the nearest space vehicle to land on. The Doctor tells Tegan and Turlough to wait whilst he goes to find Nyssa. However, a few moments later after he leaves, they hear a noise coming from the ship and Tegan goes to investigate. Turlough remains behind, but the Black Guardian appears and orders Turlough to follow and kill the Doctor. He reluctantly does so, and after he goes through the door, it closes and reseals itself. With no other choice, they make their way down the corridor in an attempt to find Nyssa and the Doctor. However, they don't get far before they encounter a strange robot with multiple arms patrolling the hallway. The robot starts to advance on them, causing them to flee. Elsewhere in the ship, the Doctor finds Nyssa and says that he should go back to the TARDIS. At that moment, a man and a woman in hazmat suits cut their way into the ship, making sure to seal the hole again before they make their way down the corridors. They eventually find the bridge and see that the whole ship is rigged to run on automatic. They remove their helmets and the woman says that they are on the wrong ship and signals back to their own ship. However, they hear the Doctor and Nyssa approaching and lie in wait for them before confronting them at gunpoint. They demand to know what they are doing there, and the man accuses them of trying to steal the same cargo that he and the woman are after. Suddenly the man, whose name is Alvier, tells the woman, whose name is Kari, that he sees their ship leaving. Kari tries to stop it but gets no response. Suddenly the blast doors begin covering all the windows as an alarm goes off on the ship. In the corridors, Tegan and Turlough continue to try and find the Doctor and Nyssa. Tegan suddenly hears a woman's voice calling from behind the sealed door, which she is convinced belongs to Nyssa. She tells Turlough to find someone to pry the door open, but instead he tries to communicate with the Black Guardian. He gets no response, but notices the skull door reappearing in the wall. Tegan then calls for him to come back and help her as she has managed to get the door open a bit. Suddenly, multiple rag-covered hands reach out from the door and grab a hold of her. She struggles to get them off, and Turlough arrives to help her. The hands then retreat back as the door closes again. He tells her about the door to the TARDIS reappearing and takes her to it. Meanwhile, back on the bridge, Kari demands that the Doctor take her and Alvier off the ship, but he says he would only help them if they put their guns away. They agree, but before they can leave, an announcement comes over the speakers, saying that the ship will soon begin docking procedures at Terminus Station. Suddenly the doors on the ship open, and dozens of cloaked, rag-wearing figures emerge from the rooms. Alvier says that he knows where they are and reveals that Terminus is a leper colony and that they are on one of its transport ships. Part 2. The ship finishes pulling at the Terminus Station as the Doctor tells Nyssa not to touch any of the lepers, who Alvier refers to as Lazarus, before fleeing further into the ship. The Doctor leads Nyssa and Kari back to the bridge so that they can plan their next move. The Doctor says they need to find Alvier so that he can learn more about Terminus, but Nyssa suggests using the computer instead. Some of the systems are switched off, and the Doctor tells Nyssa to try and find the activation keys. As she searches, she starts to feel faint but regains her composure when she spots Alvier hiding behind a chair. He laughs at his cowardice, but Nyssa says that it is alright and takes him to join the others. He reveals that his sister was sent to Terminus when she contracted the disease. He further reveals that the company that owns Terminus claims to have a cure, but he has never heard of anyone coming back. The Doctor then brings up a star chart and shows the others that Terminus appears to be located in the exact center of the universe. Meanwhile, in an effort to avoid the Lazarus, Tegan and Turlough have taken shelter in the ventilation systems and try to make their way to safety. As they climb to the next level, Turlough tries to communicate with the Black Guardian, but all he receives is another threat to complete his task of killing the Doctor. They reach the next level of ventilation ducts and take a quick break. They suddenly hear footsteps approaching, and through a grill they see a figure wearing armor fashioned like a skeleton patrolling the landing. The figure encounters the robot from earlier and asks for a report before ordering it to begin a sterilization process. Not wanting to be caught in it, Tegan and Turlough continue on through the ducts. Elsewhere on the ship, another armored figure is examining readouts from a group of machines. He grows alarmed when he notices that the readings rising steadily in the quarantine zone, and he reluctantly enters to go investigate. Just as he enters the quarantine zone, another figure enters the room and begs him to come back. The first figure, whose name is Bohr, says that he must discover the reason for the increased readings. The second figure, whose name is Valgard, goes into a barracks room just as more armored figures leave. He goes to his commander, Irak, who was also the figure that Tegan and Turlough saw. He tells Irak about Bohr, but Irak says that they can't do anything about it, and they will just have to wait for him to return for his anti-contagion drug, which is called Hydromel. On the bridge, an alert goes out over the PA system, saying that the sterilization process will begin shortly, and that all crew should disembark immediately. Nyssa brings up a schematic of the ship and says that there are two routes back to the TARDIS, and they should split up to try and find it. She goes with Alvier, whilst the Doctor goes with Kairi. As they make their way through the corridors, Nyssa says that she doesn't feel well, and after examining her, Alvier reveals that she has been contaminated. Suddenly, a robot enters and scans them before apprehending Nyssa. She begs Alvier to help her as she is dragged away, but he stays where he is. The robot brings her to an assembly area, where she is taken by Valgard and another guard named Sigurd, Valgard, feeling weak, tells Sigurd to find a medical droid so they can take their next dose of Hydromel. Nyssa asks what is going on and if he is a doctor, but he says that they are merely handling the offloading of the infected from the transport ships to bring them to someone called Garm, whom he says no one has ever returned from meeting. Nyssa, taking notice of his weakened state, knocks him to the ground and tries to escape, but she is stopped by Sigurd, who has returned with the medication. They then take her to an elevator to bring her to Garm, unaware that they are being observed by Alvir. They arrive at an assembly area where Irak is overseeing the herding of the infected. He orders Valgard to go to Garm and tell him about Bor's presence in the quarantine zone. Valgard goes to the edge of the quarantine and summons Garm, who is a large bipedal wolf with glowing red eyes, and tells him to find Bor to bring him back whether he is dead or alive. Elsewhere on the ship, the Doctor and Kari enter the corridor that Nyssa was apprehended in and find blood on the floor where the robot cut her by accident. They follow her trail and the Doctor tells Kari to call Alvir, but she says that there is a radiation leak interfering with the signal. They then hear someone calling for the Doctor, which is actually Turlo and Tegan, who they can hear from their hiding place. However, before the Doctor can go to them, he and Kari are forced to flee as the sterilization gas begins to fill the corridor. They arrive at the lift to the assembly area and take a look around for any clues as to Nyssa's whereabouts. Suddenly Valgard appears and knocks out Kari before attacking the Doctor. Part 3. Kari wakes up and aims her blaster at Valgard, but he uses the Doctor as a human shield. She fires the blaster at a wall and the ricochet manages to hit Valgard's helmet, causing him to cry out in pain and release the Doctor. The Doctor says that the armor he is wearing absorbed the worst of the blast and Kari reveals that the power pack of her blaster is dead. The Doctor says they need to get away and unwittingly leads her into the quarantine zone. Valgard regains his senses and watches them leave before going back to the barracks. Elsewhere, in a holding area, Nyssa tries to communicate with the guards, but one of the infected tells her that the guards only care about themselves and ignore the Lazarus. In the barracks room, Irak discovers that the latest batch of the Hydromel is actually just vials of coloured water. Sigurd asks why they have been deceived despite their loyalty to the Terminus Company, but Irak says that they are simply slaves of the company. Valgard bursts in and informs everyone about the Doctor and Kari going into the quarantine zone. Irak says that they might be agents from the company and says that someone needs to go in and retrieve them. Valgard questions his leadership, and Irak offers to step down from his role if Valgard volunteers to retrieve the Doctor and Kari. After he leaves, Sigurd says that he will die, but Eric says that Valgard's hatred of him will make him succeed. Sigurd then goes to the equipment room and encounters Alvir as he is putting on a set of armor to disguise himself. Sigurd treats him like any other guard, but after he leaves, he rushes to tell Irak, who assumes that Alvir is another spy from the company. Together they go to retrieve him, but instead find a decoy set of armor, and Irak angrily says that Sigurd must have imagined it. He then leads Sigurd and the rest of the guards to the holding pens, and they gather the strongest of the infected to be treated first. Nyssa is taken as well, despite her objections. Meanwhile, Alvir makes his way to the quarantine zone, where he encounters Valgard as he reluctantly sets off. Elsewhere, on the ship, Tegan and Turlo leave the docks and take a break in the corridors. Turlo asks Tegan if she could ever kill someone in cold blood, but she responds that he is weird before resuming their search for the others. In the quarantine zone, the Doctor and Kari wander the halls, and the Doctor wonders why the guards haven't repaired the radiation leaks. Kari says that they may not know how, but the Doctor thinks there may be something else at play. They then hear the sound of someone singing and they go to investigate. They encounter Bor, who is dragging something in a sack. The Doctor asks if he needs help, seeing that he is suffering from advanced radiation poisoning, and Bor gives him the sack to carry before leading him further into the quarantine zone. They come across a large reactor with various pieces of metal stacked against it, and the Doctor says it is the source of the radiation. Bor retrieves the contents from the sack, which turns out to be more metal, and he tries to stack it against the reactor, but he is too weak. They help him to sit up, and he becomes a bit more lucid. He tells them that he tried to repair the leak but accidentally damaged a group of power cables, which has only made things worse. He says that it is one of the two engines of Terminus Station, revealing that the other exploded a long time ago. He warns that if the other engine goes, it could be disastrous for the universe. Before he can reveal more, he is interrupted by Valgard, who says that they are spies. Valgard then engages the Doctor in combat. Despite being overpowered, the Doctor manages to throw Valgard into a makeshift barricade, which alarms Bor and he tries to attend to it, but he collapses again. Suddenly Garm arrives and Kari warns the Doctor. However, Garm picks up Bor, but suddenly a signal beacon sounds and he goes back the way he came, taking Boar with him. Curious, the Doctor tells Carrie to come with him as he follows Garm, but they lose track of him in the corridors. Garm arrives back at the edge of the quarantine zone, where Sigurd and a group of guards have prepared Nyssa for her cure by chaining her to a wall to wait for Garm. They take Boar from him and leave, but after they have gone, Alvir appears and tries to free Nyssa. He is unable to lock her restraints, and he instead shoots at Garm, who is unaffected by the blast. Garm ignores him as he removes Nyssa's restraints and carries her into the quarantine zone, and Alvir follows them. They arrive back at the reactor room, where Garm chains up Nyssa, and Alvir goes to free her, but he's attacked by a Valgard. In the barracks, Sigurd asks Boar what he was doing in the quarantine zone, but Boar, in the throes of delirium, says that the pilot of Terminus Station is dead, and without him the remaining engine will blow and the Big Bang will happen again. Erek arrives, and Sigurd says that Boar needs Hydromel or he will die, but Erek callously says that they should let him. Meanwhile, in the quarantine zone, the Doctor and Carrie find the bridge of Terminus Station itself and see the mummified remains of the pilot still in his chair. The Doctor takes a look at the ship's records and reveals to Carrie that Terminus Station is responsible for the creation of the universe. He says that according to the records, the fuel in one of the engines became unstable and the pilot was forced to jettison it, unwittingly sent it into the great void that reacted with it and caused the Big Bang. He says that Terminus was once capable of time travel, and the pilot jumped the station forward in time, but it was still caught in the shockwave caused by the Big Bang, which killed the pilot and damaged the remaining engine. Carrie asks about the risks of the second engine experiencing the same fault, and the Doctor says the resulting explosion would destroy the universe. Elsewhere, Tegan and Turlough have found the bridge of the transport ship and tried to find the schematics that lead them back to the TARDIS. Turlough says he needs to check something and goes back into the corridors to commune with the Black Guardian, who berates him for failing to kill the Doctor. He uses his powers to inflict pain on Turlough, who cries out that he has a plan to kill the Doctor, but he first needs to get back to the TARDIS. The Black Guardian reluctantly tells him to find the door to the TARDIS and then releases him when Tegan approaches. Tegan asks what he was doing, and he says that he remembers how to get back to the TARDIS, leading her off down the corridors into the docks. They eventually find a bypass switch that the Black Guardian told Turlough about, and he tinkers with it, causing it to explode. The explosion triggers a chain reaction which activates the dormant computer in the bridge of Terminus Station. The Doctor tells Carrie that the computer is preparing to jettison the unstable fuel and they need to stop it or the universe will be destroyed. Part 4. Valgard demands to know where the Doctor and Carrie have gone, but Alvir continues to fight him as Garm again removes Nyssa from her restraints and carries her away. Alvir manages to incapacitate Valgard, but sees that Garm and Nyssa have gone. He looks around for his blaster, but he sees it is near the damaged engine. Valgard warns him against trying to retrieve it, saying that the radiation output could kill him. Valgard then reveals that he once served under the same rebel leadership as Alvir, saying that he recognizes his weapons and combat training. He says that he was betrayed and sold out to the company for the reward on his head. Valgard asks for his help to get up, but Alvir ignores him and asks where Nyssa was taken. Valgard said that he doesn't know, but wherever it is the source of the cure. Alvir leaves to go find Nyssa, and after he goes, Valgard gets up, revealing his weakened state to be a ruse, and he retrieves Alvir's gun. Meanwhile, in the air ducts, Turlough recovers from the explosion, and he and Tegan see the doorway to the TARDIS beginning to appear, but it doesn't appear fully. They go back to the bypass switch, but they suddenly hear an announcement that the ship is getting ready for blastoff. Tegan says they need to stop it and goes back to the bridge. She calls out to anyone to help her as the automatic countdown begins. She cries out in frustration and slams her fist on the control panel, which aborts the launch sequence. Unbeknownst to her, the door to the TARDIS has fully appeared and Turlough has gone back inside. The Black Guardian suddenly appears on the external view screen and berates Turlough for his continued failure to kill the Doctor. He then causes the crystal he gave to Turlough to shatter and explode, causing Turlough to scream in pain. Meanwhile, back on the bridge of Terminus Station, the Doctor and Carrie try in vain to flip the abort switch to stop the fuel from being jettisoned. Carrie says that the pilot must have had great strength, causing both her and the Doctor to realise that Garm could be of assistance, and they rush off to find him. Elsewhere, in the quarantine zone, Alvir encounters Garm and asks what he is doing with the infected. Garm says that he is treating them, but admits that not all survive the process. Alvir asks after Nyssa, and Garm says that he will take him to her. He takes him to a room, but suddenly leaves, having been summoned by the signal beacon. Alvir enters the room and is ambushed by Nyssa, who seems to have fully been cured. A delighted Alvier says they need to go, but Nyssa says that there are thousands of infected still on board and that the process isn't foolproof. She says that it needs to be carefully overseen as there could still be side effects. However, Alvier refuses to listen and again says they need to leave. Meanwhile, the doctor and Kari encounter Garm, who agrees to help them. After some initial struggle, Garm's superior strength allows him to flip the abort switch, which allows the doctor to complete the abort sequence. The doctor thanks him for his assistance, and Garm begs him to destroy the signal beacon, which the doctor had kept, so that he can be free. The doctor gladly destroys it and leads Kari to find the others, but they are apprehended by Valgard. He prepares to execute them when Nyssa suddenly appears, distracting him long enough to allow Alvier to knock him to the ground and disarm him. The doctor happily greets Nyssa, and she tells him about being cured, but highlighting the flaws in the process. The doctor asks if it could be fixed, and Nyssa says that it could if Garm had free will to do as he wished, and the doctor reveals what he did for him. Valgard says that it doesn't matter as the company has no interest in actually curing people. Nyssa asks if he and the other guards do, asking would they help her if she could ensure a continuous supply of Hydromel. Valgard thinks for a moment and agrees to help them. He leads them back to the barracks where Sigurd is tending to the dying boar. Valgard tells us to surprise Sigurd of Nyssa's offer, and they watch as the doctor breaks into the locked crates containing the Hydromel. The doctor tells Kari and Alvier to go and disconnect the engine cables, for fear that the engine accidentally might get restarted. Nyssa examines the Hydromel and says that she can synthesize it as well as improve its effectiveness. Sigurd says that the company would send troops to avenge the loss of the station, but Nyssa points out that no sane soldier would ever come to the station because of its reputation. Emboldened by her words, Sigurd agrees to join them and takes the Hydromel to treat Bor. A short while later, Irak returns from having gone searching for Garm when he discovered the signal beacon missing. He is surprised by the appearance of everyone in his office, and Valgard reminds him of the deal that they made in relation to stepping down from leadership. The doctor interrupts the power struggle by asking to be taken to the damaged engine so that he can ensure that it won't reactivate now that Kari and Alvier have destroyed the cables. As they make their way towards it, they encounter Tegan, who tells them about Turlo going back to the TARDIS on his own. The doctor gives out to her for not staying in the TARDIS as he instructed, but Nyssa chides him by saying that he could at least say that he is happy to see her. Nyssa then pulls Tegan to the side whilst the doctor tells Valgard that they will need Garm's help to ensure repairs are carried out correctly and advises a dental approach in dealing with him. A distressed Tegan then calls the doctor, and when he goes to her, Nyssa reveals that she intends to stay on Terminus to help with the cure. The doctor and Tegan say that it isn't safe for her, but she says that Valgard and the infected need her skills more than they do. Seeing that she is committed, the doctor commends her bravery and says goodbye. A tearful Tegan embraces her, and Nyssa assures her that she will be fine, saying that she is tough like her. Later, on the TARDIS, Turlo regains consciousness as the Black Guardian informs him that the doctor is returning. Turlo says that he doesn't care about their deal anymore, as he cannot kill the doctor. The Black Guardian says that he has little choice in the matter, and that he has only one last chance to kill the doctor. End of the story. So, trivia time.
Trivia time. So, trivia for Terminus. Air date, 15th to 23rd of February, 1983. The writer of this story is Steve Gallagher, depending on how you pronounce it. Second and final Doctor Who writing credit for Steve. We previously saw his work in Warrior's Gate. The director of this story is Mary Ridge. This is her only Doctor Who credit. And Mary passed away back in 2000.
I just noticed something weird. So Steve Gallagher / Gallagher has only exclusively written ending stories. And his tenure as a writer on Doctor Who ends with an ending story.
Interesting observation. Yes. The opening and closing scenes of this story, which were the Turlo bits, were written by Eric Saward, who's the script editor at the time, like, or the producer, I can't remember. This story contains one of three descriptions of how the universe started according to Doctor Who. So there's one in Castrovalva and there's one in audio story called Slipback. Since we don't know the exact fuel used by Terminus. We know that it produces radiation as a side effect of the energy generation. It is plausible that Terminus is fusion powered by hydrogen, and its release of fuel and the rushing of hydrogen is what gets mentioned in Castro Valva, that it could technically be the same thing. To be honest, I don't think they thought that far ahead with it, personally speaking. This story is well remembered for its controversial at the time and shocking when I was watching it the other night. Scenes of Nyssa gradually removing her clothes. I'm sure we'll talk about that more and have another discussion point on it in trivia in a little bit, but that was quite shocking when the story aired. Because bear in mind, like at the end of the story, like when she's saying goodbye, she's literally in like a tank top and like a pair of like frilly undershorts. Like, she's in her underwear, basically. Like,
I just thought she was just wearing a slip the whole time.
yeah, I mean, it could have been a slip as well. I mean, she was wearing like frilly undershorts, like frilly underpants. But like, I don't know if her top was meant to be a top or it was meant to be just a slip that was under her top or whatever. Point is, took people a bit by surprise. Despite the grim tone of this story, and it is quite grim, like the themes of disease and death, etc., it is apparently the only story from season 20 in which no one dies. Bar the guy who was dead at the start, which is the pilot. He was already dead.
Yeah, he was dead when we got here.
Yeah.
Yeah, thinking back, yeah, absolutely.
So we're going to talk a little bit about mythology in a second, particularly Norse mythology. But before we get to Norse mythology, there is a little bit of ancient Greek tied up in this as well. I did always think that Terminus comes from the Greek. That may just be me, trying to be intelligent and failing.
I thought it was more Latin
Yeah,
or Roman.
maybe. Might be more Latin. Yeah. I suppose us is more of a Latin
But
ending.
all I can think of is the Heroes of Olympus series, Terminus, the guardian of the boundary, who just bitches and moans
That
about his job.
is actually don't that is exactly what I was thinking of. I was thinking of Percy Jackson, and I was just thinking of Percy Jackson and the Heroes of Olympus rather than, or Percy Jackson and the Olympians rather than Percy Jackson and the Heroes of Olympus. That's exactly what I was thinking. Thank you, man
You're
who lives in
welcome.
my brain. The other ancient Greek word is actually, so hydromel comes from two ancient Greek words. So hydro, obviously coming from the word for water, and then mel comes from the word for honey, so it actually translates as honeyed water, which is also mead, which in a way kind of ties back to the whole Norse thing, if we're talking about like popular correlations and stuff. This was the last TV story to have three regular companions up until 2018. So in 2018, The Woman Who Fell to Earth, we end up getting our new companions of Ryan, Graham, and Yaz. That's not to say Doctor Who hasn't done three companion stories after this. Particularly in the revival era, we had Boomtown, we also had School Reunion, both of which had Mickey in them, but Mickey isn't actually a companion proper. And in Boom and School Reunion, Sarah Jane wasn't a companion anymore, so that doesn't really work either. And then we have The Impossible Astronaut, which has River, but again, she wasn't really a companion in that story, So,
But like
prominent character, yes, companion, not so much.
if you took away like because obviously it was announced that Mark Strickson in Radio Times or whatever would be, or presumably it was announced that he was coming on as the new companion. So like if at the time this technically wouldn't have been the last one, the last one probably would have been Earthshock. because we have no idea how long Turlough's sticking around for.
Yeah, but in terms of actually looking back at it, Turlough is considered a companion now, so this is the last. But at the time, it wouldn't have been.
Yeah.
This is one of the very few stories where we see the TARDIS interior, but not the exterior. And it's also the only story, I think possibly ever, where the chameleon circuit actually works. In the sense that, like, the TARDIS blends in. Now, it's not, I think you could probably argue that it's maybe not the chameleon circuit itself, that, like, it's the whole other thing, but still, it blends in. Mm. Mark Strickson apparently thought that the leper colony idea was a bit sick. While Peter Davison felt it didn't really go anywhere. We can talk about that more later on, I'm sure. The pilot, who we see, the dead pilot that I mentioned a while ago, was originally dressed with cobwebs. But Peter Davison objected, saying that the pilot wasn't meant to be dead, but simply moving very slowly. Because he travels through time. And so Mary Ridge ordered that they be removed. So it's not that he'd been dead for centuries and that he would be covered in cobwebs. It's that, like, he moved the ship through time, etc. I don't quite get it, but that's why the cobwebs were removed. The production for this, though, was fraught with problems. So there was technical difficulties, including problems with costumes, delays due to electrical problems, a misbuilt set. I'll go into some of these in a bit more detail in a second. And this meant that the production ran seriously late and several films were taped really quickly, which Peter Davison really didn't like. One of the things with the electricals is that, once more, and this is quite common in Doctor Who, particularly I think this becomes very common during John Nathan Turner's era, is an industrial dispute between the BBC and, in this case, the BBC and the Electricians Union, which resulted in a major reorganization of shooting schedules and the whole crew, like I said, basically working against the clock. Even the first day was plagued with problems, so a power failure resulted in a 2-hour delay. And then when the crew was finally ready to go, Mary Ridge discovered that that one set had been erected off of its mark. So they had to, like, move the set to make it fit up with the way it was planned. Then Jonathan Turner was forced to call a halt to the recording of scenes involving the interior of the TARDIS console because the correct circuitry was missing. This meant that Mary Ridge had to record the sequences on other sets which were not properly lit yet. Later, it was learned that neither the drone robot props had been tested before being brought into the studio, and only one of them was found to be working correctly, which is why we only see one throughout the story. Despite all of this, Mary was able to complete almost all of the scenes set within the TARDIS and the adjoining liner corridor. But they were rushed. They were done a lot of times in one take. There was little to no rehearsal. Mary Ridge had never exceeded her allotted shooting schedule in her career, and she had no intention of starting now. Unfortunately, she did end up going over anyway due to other problems that proved too much for her to recover from. So that forced the team to schedule another couple of days of filming the following week, right after Sarah Sutton's farewell party. So after her farewell party, they still had to do some filming. So the freelance props firm that was making the veneer armor, or the Vanir armor, rather, there was a bit of a miscommunication there. Rod Vass, who was the guy, he was asked to fabricate, or he thought that what he was asking to fabricate was being purely decorative. And so when he delivered the costumes and found that they'd be required for combat, he was quite shocked. The costumes were extremely noisy. I think we could even hear a bit of, like, the noise that they make in the sound mix of the episode. Mm-hmm. So with any sort of vigorous activity, they were really noisy. And it was costly to get them fixed or sort of address that problem. But like I said, I still think in some scenes you can kind of hear them, they're quite loud. The visual effects designer Peter Pegram was responsible for Carrie and Oliver's helmets, which we're going to talk about those helmets later, I'm sure, because they were a thing, which he thought were only to be carried and never worn. So when the actors put them on, they found that there was a lack of air holes.
Jesus.
So they had to be modified. I love the way as well, like the way that this note is made on, by the way, we've discussed about this before, I'll come back to second, that we get a lot of our trivia either from the DVD or Blu-ray, like from the other commentaries and stuff like that, but also from the TARDIS fandom wiki. That has now moved, just FYI for people, so there's now an ad-free version of the TARDIS wiki, because the no offense to fan to the fandom wiki website, but it was so hard to read anything on that website. It's now moved, so yay. All the same information, different website. But I know, but I love that, like in their summary of this, they're saying like, oh, that because of the lack of air holes, the helmet's easily fogged up. I'm like, also it helps if you have air holes to, breathe. Interestingly enough, with all of the overrunning in production, part one actually underran in terms of time. So Eric Saward asked Stephen Gallagher to provide two new 1 minute scenes. Stephen misunderstood the request and instead extended several existing scenes to fill out the 2 minutes worth of material. The amendments ended up being disregarded. Stephen thought that this was a much greater intellectual experience than his previous script. He described it as a sober affair compared to the box of firecrackers that was Warrior's Gate. I don't know if I necessarily agree.
Oh, well, that's good. I think that'll be an interesting talking point. Because
Yeah, I
I
mean, a
think
sober,
I kind
he
of.
describing this as more intellectual and a sober affair compared to the box of firecrackers that was Warrior's Gate. I don't know if I describe Warrior's Gate as a box of firecrackers, but.
Well, I think maybe he means in the sense of like he was a lot more shouty.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot more boisterous characters in Warrior's Gate than there is here, I think.
He also wanted Garm to look spooky and also to only be seen in the shadow. So he was quite surprised when he saw the full costume. According to Eliza Goddard, who plays Carrie, the Garm costume was so hot that the actor inside, RJ Bell, actually fainted several times during recording. Oh, the days when like costumes actually required massive sacrifice on the part of the actor, which I know sometimes they still do, but like these full body things are insane. Peter Davison has said that Nyssa was his favorite companion, and he was upset that Sarah was leaving. Particularly because, so again, the TARDIS wiki is saying she didn't leave her of her own accord and she didn't want to go. I couldn't find anything on the wiki that particularly explained why she had to go. I don't know if it was just that her contract came to an end and they wouldn't renew it, or what. I may have to go back over the Blu-ray and see if they mention it, because I don't know, like in your Space Helmet for a Cow books, does it mention why Sarah left?
I think it is, and I think like because we have her rambling next week, we
Yeah.
can do a small
We might
bit
be able to do some
of
research and fill that in next week, yeah.
yeah.
So Janet Fielding has been wearing the same outfit for the last three stories, I want to say.
Is this story number? You know, she came back in Arkham
Arkham
Infinity.
Infinity.
Then we had Snake Dance.
Okay, she's
No.
wearing the same outfit for four stories now.
Yeah.
Which we discussed in a previous episode that she didn't actually like that outfit very much. Apparently, during a scene, one of the Lazars actors accidentally grabbed her top, causing her to expose herself. I'm guessing they reshot that because
Yes,
I
because
didn't notice any Janet boob while I was watching it.
I didn't, but like I was watching, kind of going, "How in the name of God has someone not grabbed a tit or fucking yanked that thing down by accident?"
So circling back around to mythology for a second. So, like I said, Terminus, Paddy correctly remembered, the Latin is comes from the Roman gods. To do with boundaries, I think. But we do have Norse gods in here. I am again going to take a slight issue with the way the TARDIS wiki phrased something, which is they said that Steve Gallagher took inspiration from Norse mythology, naming the Vanir after a lesser group of fertility gods. I take issue with the word lesser. They're just different. It's not lesser. Yep. So we'll get into the individual names in a second, but just for anyone who's not familiar, the Vanir, however you call them, are one group of gods in Norse mythology, and the other group are the Aesir. The Aesir are probably the gods that most people are familiar with. They include Odin, Thor, Frigg, etc.
Tyr, Baldur, Loki's part of that pantheon. Yeah.
All that group. They're generally associated with war, wisdom, and governance. They are the warriors who go to Valhalla and all that. That's all associated with them, right? The Vanir, on the other hand, are more associated with fertility, prosperity, and the natural world. So that's where we have Freyr, her brother, and a number of other gods. So they're more so to do with that side of the house. They were originally two different groups of gods, and they did eventually merge together in mythology, leading to a period of cooperation amongst the gods.
The Vanir are more kind of hippie-ish.
Yeah. I do love in, we were mentioning Percy Jackson a while ago, Rick Riordan wrote a series called the Magnus Chase series, which is amazing. I think it's his best work. And that is based on Norse mythology. And you do get an interesting look into some, like the difference between some of the Aesir and the Vanir. Now, obviously, that's a retelling for children. But it's interesting. Also, God of War Ragnarok.
Yep.
And God of War in general, but God of War Ragnarok, I think, gives a bit more of the comparison of the two.
The depiction of the Vanir in God of War Ragnarok is fucking brilliant.
Yeah. But circling back around, we have a couple of people here. So we have Bor, who actually was the father of Odin. So the Odin was an Aesir, but Bor was Vanir. Sigurd. And then we have Erek, who comes from the name Eric. And then Garm was named after a sort of a big dog, the monstrous hellhound from Norse mythology, who appears during Ragnarok.
He's essentially the Norse version of Cerberus. He's Hel's guardian dog.
Yeah. And does often get conflated with Fenrir's wolf, who will get mentioned in a later story. Anyway, mythology for the day. We do also have the term Lazar, which I think is quite clear. It was an archaic word for leper, and it comes from the biblical figure of Lazarus, obviously. So a lot of different mythological elements coming in the story.
I actually thought I forgot that Bor, B-O-R, is Odin's dad, because I thought I got him confused with Sir Bors, one of the Knights of the Round Table, B-O-R-S. And I thought they were bringing a bit of Arthurian legend into it as well.
Yeah. In fairness, it is an interesting mix of them, do you know? Particularly, obviously, Lazar for leper, and obviously these people clearly have some form of leprosy or something. But also the fact that like Lazarus rose again, do you know, in this Garm has the power to save some of the people and they end up getting better. So the instability in the TARDIS was originally caused by Nyssa's experiments, which I think explains a little bit at the start, where the doctor's like, "What was she doing?" I'm like, What makes you think it had anything to do with the blue chemical she was making in her bedroom? But whatever. Carrie was originally named Yoni, until Eric Saward observed that was the Sanskrit word for female reproductive organs. So decided not to go with that.
Oh yeah, but years down the line, they don't have an issue with someone calling someone Mickey.
Also, in the original story, Carrie actually contracted the Lazar disease in part three, and Boar died in that same episode in the original version of this. In regards to Nissa's leaving, and we're going to circle back around again to that skirt thing, but apparently, Steve Gallagher wanted to hint at an underlying sexuality to the relationship between the Doctor and Nissa. But apparently, the kiss that they had, so where the Doctor kissed her on the cheek when they're saying goodbye, apparently that was Peter and Sarah. So originally, they were meant to shake hands. But I do have a bit to talk about later on about the Doctor and Nissa's dynamic in this story, because I think there's a few bits definitely to dissect. The goodbye scene with Janet, which is the same scene as the goodbye scene with Peter, but obviously she has a separate conversation with Tegan. Apparently Sarah Sutton was genuinely crying during that scene, which if she didn't actually want to leave the show, I would completely understand. Apparently Sarah was disappointed that this was her final story, and she could not understand the rationale for Nissa taking her clothes off.
Yeah, because she starts off at the start of the story, she doesn't have her jacket on, so it's the top half of the slip because she's in the privacy of her own room doing sexy science, running experiments.
Also, I do love her outfit at the start of this.
I'm sure
It is amazing.
I'm sure all female scientists when they're working at home are in their bra, the whole time.
And you know that Shaw definitely is.
Oh yeah, absolutely, and those go-go boots. But it's basically as it goes on. She strips off the skirt because she says she's getting too hot, but also too weak from the Lazar disease. And all that comes into my head is, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but Niles's breakdown in an episode of Frasier, where he just basically starts stripping off his clothes. He's like, "Oh, this is so good. I feel so much better now." And he just gets stark bollocking. It's actually one of my favorite scenes in Frasier. So funny.
Sarah Sutton later claimed that it was a quote unquote parting gift to her male fans. I don't think she needed to take the skirt off. She looked quite sexy with the skirt on, so whatever. Let's go into our cast though, because we've been talking about trivia for quite a while. So last week we mentioned that Turlough is played by Mark Strickson. Just a bit more background on Mark. So he studied drama at RADA, which is the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts in London. Prior to his role as Turlough, he had appeared in several episodes of Angels. After he left Doctor Who, he appeared in other roles, including the young Ebenezer Scrooge, in an adaptation of A Christmas Carol starring George C. Scott. Eventually, Mark emigrated to Australia, where actually he studied zoology at university. He now lives in New Zealand, and he did also direct a few wildlife programs with such people as the late great Steve Irwin, which I think is a very interesting sort of
I think that's pretty
gamut
cool.
of work.
Yeah.
Moving on to our other cast, so the Black Guardian, like I said, that's Valentine of Valentine Dial, appearance 304. We previously saw him in the Armageddon Factor, Modern Undead, and we will see him once more again in Enlightenment. Carrie is played, as I mentioned, by Liza Goddard. She was once married to Colin Baker, who is our sixth Doctor. This is her only Doctor Who acting credit, though, and her non-Who credits include Woof, The Intruders, The Brothers, and Casualty. Olvir is played by Dominic Guard. This is the only Doctor Who acting credit for Dominic. His non-Who credits include The Go-Between, Picnic at Hanging Rock, and the 1978 version of Lord of the Rings.
Before you go on, was Woof the show about the boy that could turn into a dog?
I think so, yes. Eric, was played by Martin Potter. Only Doctor Who acting credit for Martin. His non-Who credits include Nicholas and Alexandria, The Legend of Robin Hood, Emmerdale, and All Creatures Great and Small. Valgard is played by Andrew Burt. Only Doctor Who acting credit for Andrew. His non-Who credits include The Legend of King Arthur, Emmerdale Farm, Worship, and he was Gulliver in the amazing Gulliver and Lilliput that also starred Elizabeth Slayton.
I was like, he looks so fucking familiar. What is he from?
He looked so familiar. And you did message, so Bai did message me saying something around our giant traveler or something. And I was like, okay. Whatever. And then I was watching the episode. I'm like, he does look fucking familiar. Like, where do I know him from? And I pulled up his IMDb to fill in the trivia. And I was like, most commonly known for The Legends of King Arthur, Emmerdale Farm, Worship. And scrolling down through. Scrolling. And, like, Gulliver and Lilliput was done in, like, this late 70s, I think.
Yeah.
Or early 80s. And so, like, I had to go down below the fold, like, click see more a couple of times. And finally, I was like, oh my god, he's Gulliver. And once I see it, I can't unsee it. Do you know?
Yeah.
But I do also imagine, because now we know how tall he is normally, he still would have been a giant compared to Elizabeth Slayton. Sadly, Andrew passed away in 2018, just to end that on a bit of a downer. Sigurd is played by Tim Munro. This is the second and final Doctor Who acting credit for Tim. We previously saw him as Anu in The Creature from the Pit. Bor is played by Peter Benson. Only Doctor Who acting credit for Peter. His non-Who credits include Heartbeat, which he was on for like 30 years or something. Albion Market, Trinity Tales, and The Great Train Robbery. Peter passed away in 2018. Garm is played by RJ Bell. Only Doctor Who acting credit for RJ. His non-Who credits include Superman 3, Haunted Honeymoon, and The Punk. RJ passed away in 2006. It was a very long trivia with lots of rambling side bits, but do you know, like, that's what we do.
Yes, it is.
And if you don't like it, you can skip past until we talk about everything else.
Yes. But then you're missing comedic gold at times. At times.
So we have done the story summary, thank you very much, Paddington, and we have done the trivia, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And now we're on to our character discussion. So again, as per usual, we have the Doctor, we have the companions, who in this case are Nyssa, Tegan, and Turlough. Do you want to put Carrie or Alvir in as a story-based companion, or just prominent characters?
I think just prominent characters.
Okay. And then, in terms of the Vanir, so Erak, Valgard, you had Sigurd down originally. I wasn't sure if you still wanted to discuss Sigurd as a character.
I think Valgard probably... Valgard and Erak deserve their own little speeches. But as the story went on, I was like, Bor and Sigurd, we could probably talk about as the Vanir as a group, rather than individual entries. Because I thought Bor would only be something small, but then he actually ended up having quite an interesting turn of events, I think.
Yeah, where Sigurd kind of went the opposite direction. I thought he was going to do more, and then he didn't. We have Garm, and then as the villain proper, we have the Black Guardian. So I would kind of put Carrie down to Garm, all just sort of in prominent characters.
Yeah.
Veering pretty much closer to one side and closer to the other side, but still all generally in the middle.
The closest thing to a... like, there's no real villain in this. Like, you could say that Erak, or Eric, whichever way to pronounce it, he's on the evilest scale of prominent character. But, like, even then, if he's still just a problem.
Is he, though? Do you know what I mean?
I think like, there are aspects of his character for the rest of the Vanir that he's probably the villain.
Yeah.
As opposed to like the actual impact of the story. But like, even though, like, we'll get into it now, but I think, like, a lot of people here, either parts of their story or parts of their impact that I actually wanted to discuss because I thought it added to my, I'm kind of giving the game away here, like, but my interest in the story.
Okay, but let's start with the man himself. So, we have had some questionable, I wouldn't say questionable, we've had some thoughts, let's put that way.
Yeah.
We've had some thoughts about Peter Davison, the Fifth Doctor. Those thoughts any different this time around, Paddy?
We were so close. We were so fucking close. We were fucking five minutes away. Up, and he fucked it. Oh, God. I was going to say, like, he's concussed Ronan O'Gara into 2009's Lions tour trying for a drop goal. It's like, and it's just like, he doesn't even have a concussion to fucking put the blame on him.
I did not understand most of that reference.
Yeah, no, like the Lions tour, which when England, Ireland, Scotland, and Wales put a combined rugby team to go on a tour of a Southern Hemisphere country, and they take on the national team at the end of the tour. And we were in a kind of like, it was a tight game, and Ronan O'Gara, who was concussed at the time, tried for a drop goal when he should have kept possession, and he missed it. But the thing was, and a lot of people blamed him until they found out, oh, no, he was actually concussed.
Okay.
Yeah. So judgment is a jackass, I think. Yeah, here he's just a jackass. And we get into it. Like, so he's absolutely fine with Nyssa initially when it's the two of them in episode one. Where they're trying to discover what is the mystery of Terminus Station. And then he's grand when he's with hanging around with Carrie. You know, it's she's his pair of hands for this story as such. And I actually enjoyed his moments with Garm, you know, there's a bit there where he tries to use a signal beacon to kind of like almost like an electronic leash to bring Garm on. But Garm is like, look, I'm here already. I'll do whatever you want me to do. You don't need to try and deceive me. And then he just, like, the Doctor, again, is very open and honest with him. And then he actually looked genuinely happy at the idea of being able to set Garm free, you know, because he can tell that Garm is inherently good, despite his big glowing red eyes and his we've seen everything else. But at the very minute Tegan shows up at the end, the look of disgust on his face, it's like, what are you doing here? I told you to stay in the TARDIS, blah, 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 blah. And, like, this is like, you know, you could at least say that you're happy to see her. And she should have just said the word bitch at the end, you know? Because I'm like, and I've been thinking back over it, and like, there's people that we didn't like the pairing because the chemistry wasn't there in the past. There's going to be people coming up when we watched initially that we didn't like the dynamic there because it was weird. I think that this is the worst Doctor companion dynamic of all, is Tegan and the Fifth Doctor. And like,
I completely agree with you, right? I'll let you talk more about the Doctor in a second, but I need to get this thing off my chest, right? So, the Doctor and Tegan have a little bit of an interaction at the beginning of the story, which is fine. It goes grand. Nothing major, right? Then we get to the end of the story. Nyssa's talking about how they're going to see Tegan again, and the Doctor's sort of like, oh yeah, no, fuck it, her. We're going to see her again. And she's like, Nyssa's kind of like, what the fuck is wrong with you? It's fine. But then he sees her and just loses his fucking shit. And like I said, Nyssa's like, you could at least, you know, you could say you're happy to see her. And do you know what I've realized this has been this whole time? All right.
Well,
if you think about the evolution of the Doctor knowing Nyssa and the evolution of the Doctor knowing Tegan, the Doctor met Nyssa first. Mm-hmm. They got along quite well on Trakken and whatever. And this Doctor, because if you remember how 4 regenerated into five, right, with this sort of like future self thing. This doctor went and got Nyssa and brought her to this point in time to join the TARDIS crew. Tegan wandered in and then stuck around because he couldn't get her home. And then she just stuck around because she wanted to stay. No, the doctor wanted to travel with Nyssa, and Tegan is like her third wheel best friend that she insists on coming with them as well. And the doctor's just like, fine, she can come. But like, it's like Tegan is her annoying little sister or something. Mm. And the doctor's just like, oh, what? Oh, fine. Do to keep Nyssa happy. Like, that is it. I'm convinced. The doctor really liked Nyssa. The fifth doctor maybe had a bit of a romantic thing for Nyssa, according to your man. Mm-hmm. And he was like, Tegan keeps Nyssa happy. Tegan's like her pet. Tegan is Nyssa's dog that gets to stay on the TARDIS and gets given out to when she wanders in front of the doctor as he's trying to walk somewhere. I'm convinced of it. He doesn't want her there. She's only there because Nyssa wants her. That you cannot convince me otherwise. Particularly if you think back to Ark of Infinity, where she said that she was going to come along again, and the look on his face of, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
We abandoned this bitch at the side of the road, and now she's back again.
And like, it is kind of, I won't say mind-boggling, because I think that's a bit too harsh. But it is genuinely making me scratch my head that when they appeared together in Power of the Doctor, so like the 60th special, and you know, there was such fan happiness and everything, I'm like, what am I missing? Like,
the only thing I can think of is that Witness is now gone, but their dynamic evolves again, because that's got to be it,
because like, I genuinely, and not to sound like prickish or condescending or anything like that, I would love if someone that loves the Dr. Tegan dynamic, the fifth Dr. Tegan dynamic, that disagrees with what my opinion is thus far, I'd love for that person to message us so we can actually have a good conversation about it. Because sometimes I miss stuff that other people pick up on and vice versa. And I like having those conversations, kind of like what we aim to do here on the podcast. Mm. But it's just like, It really affects my enjoyment of the story when this is brought into it. Because if it's like a fundamental disagreement of a course of action taking place within the story, and the Doctor acts like an asshole, like, you know, okay, like, it's grand, because it's a story dynamic. It's something it's a disagreement based on an action that needs to be taken. Here it's just disdain for her very fucking presence around him.
But also, if you think about it, he hasn't seen her in fucking hours.
Yeah.
And in that time, Nyssa got kidnapped, nearly died of fucking radiation poisoning or whatever the fuck it was. The universe nearly ended. You get to see your quote-unquote friend again, and you're pissed off that she didn't stay in the TARDIS with the new guy who she's super fucking sussy of for fucking hours. While you wandered off after Nyssa, who's her best friend, who was in danger for all she knew because she wandered into the void. You really expect her to stay there for hours with no word? Like, come on. Like, particularly because at one point, doesn't the Doctor go back and he can't get into the TARDIS? Or did I imagine that? Or was that Turlough I'm thinking of?
That was Turlough.
I thought the Doctor went back with Carrie to try and go into the TARDIS, or did I imagine that?
No, he went back to try and find it, but then he saw Nyssa's blood on the floor. It was weird because apparently they went along a different route that brought them to that exact same point.
Mm. So yeah, I mean, the Doctor for the rest of the story was, I would say, grand. He got along quite well with Carrie.
Which
I did like him with Garm.
Sorry to cut across you, like, which is also again raises fucking questions, because when you first met this woman, she pointed a gun at you.
Yeah.
How can you treat her better than the person that has been traveling with you and has had your back a lot? Oh, the person that fucking kept you safe during your post-regenerative haze.
And who knew you well enough to know that that fucker last week wasn't you?
Yes. Oh, that's
Nissa
so
thought it
funny.
Was you.
Oh, but it's so infuriating. It's so infuriating. I'm sorry.
It's so bad. And, like, the worst thing is that you... this happens in the scene where Nissa announces that she's leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor's like, no, you can't. You can't. You'd be in danger. And then he kisses her goodbye. No, it's kissing the cheek, whatever. But he kisses her goodbye. And I'm like, you just tore the face off Tegan. And now Nissa's leaving. Tegan's probably like, please don't fucking leave. You can't leave me alone with him.
Yeah.
This other guy's fucking weird. And so got him. Dude, seriously. You can't leave me. It's he was doing... I wouldn't say he was doing so good, but he was doing good.
Mm.
He was doing good, and at the last minute he just shat a bit.
Yeah. Because, like, the thing about this particular story is it's not the Doctor's story. It is Nissa, it's Nissa, but it is also, by an extension, it's Nissa and Turlough's stories. Because, yeah. And like Tegan is involved in it as well. I'll have more. No, because like what I mean, like, we, not in a bad way, because like when we actually get to that discussion point, she's actually quite integral to some parts of it. But she's not the main focus, if you get what I'm saying. Whereas like the Doctor here, he's essentially the C plot, even though it's treated as the A plot. It's actually kind of like he's the C aspect of that A plot. I wonder what that C stands for.
Punt.
Yes, it does. But yeah, that's pretty much my thing. Do you have anything else to add, or can we go on to happy talk?
We've been talking about this about 13 minutes already. Let's move on.
Okay, happy talk.
Yeah. How do you want to order these three?
I know it's Nissa's.
Usually, we do the departing companion last. So
we do, and actually, I think that's fair. So I want to do Turlough first.
Okay.
Because my comments about Tegan don't really make sense unless I talk about Turlough first.
Okay.
To me, anyway. So, look, I know that Turlough's whole thing isn't contributing to the main plot, apart from setting events into motion. Because, like, he's mostly with Tegan for the entire time. But I do like his story. Because, in a way, it kind of reminds me of Finn in The Last Jedi. His own personal hero's journey within the bigger story that's going on. And like we get a bigger insight into how he operates, like how he talks about, like, I tend to be a lot more charismatic. You know, if I can get my way with a smile and a nice word, like that's where I really enjoyed that sequence of understanding why he is the way that he is. I'll look at your face though. This is going to be a very interesting conversation, I think. All right. And because like, even when he wasn't under the control of the Black Guardian, I can see that this is his modus operandi. Like, I know that I said, look, he's an absolute asshole, but at least I kind of get where, like, that's how he drives himself to, like, or what drives him in being that asshole. I don't know if that's the right way of saying it. But what I did like in the story was his growth as things went on. Like that conversation he has with Tegan over the, could you kill someone? And like she was saying, like, oh, if it was to save a friend or whatever. But he's like, could you do it in cold blood? And as it goes on, eventually, you kind of, the very last episode, it hints that he's gone from not wanting to kill the Doctor because he doesn't want to be caught rotten or implicated in it. But it's actually going to grow into, he doesn't actually believe the Doctor is, he doesn't want to kill him because he doesn't think the Doctor deserves to die because of the Black Guardian's whole thing. And it's actually going to be very interested for next week. because I liked the growth that I saw in Turlough here.
Yeah. Like, I would agree with you that, like, Turlough and Tegan's story is literally completely independent from everything else.
Yeah.
Particularly when we know that even the crash at the beginning, the incident that tipped it all off at the beginning, in the original script, that wasn't Turlough's fault, it was Nissa's fault.
Mm-hmm.
So, I find it interesting that he spends the whole story separate from the Doctor. Like, we don't... Do we even see them reconnect at the end? No, we don't. Like,
no.
He doesn't interact... He interacts with the Doctor once, and that may not have even been in the original script. Mm-hmm. I had a couple of notes on Turlough just at the beginning. I'm like, dude, shouting at the ceiling is super fucking suspicious. Like, just saying. Like, subtlety is not this boy's friend by any stretch. But going back to his scene with Tegan, where he was saying, like, oh, if I can get, oh, you know, a smile can go a long way and blah, blah, blah. I fucking hated it.
Okay.
Because it showcased how he's the fucking king of gaslighting.
Hmm.
That he'll just use his charm and convince whatever, because Tegan caught him at the roundel or whatever the fuck they called it. And he's just there the whole time trying to use his charm. Like, why would I need to go near that? I'm like, you are such a gaslighting, manipulative asshole. And, like, the way he spoke to her is so misogynistic of, well, you could smile more. Like, that whole thing of some guy saying, like, people would like you more if you smile more. Get fucked. If I don't want to smile, I won't. Do you know? And as someone who grew up with people telling me to smile more, I fucking hate it.
Mm.
I think Tegan is a very strong, very passionate, both mm-hmm. in her anger and in her sorrow and in her empathy and whatever. She's a very passionate person. She does mm-hmm. not need this fucking snake oil salesman to come mm-hmm. in and tell her how to get along with people. I'm like, no, like, dude, get fucked. Get away from me. You're such a creep. And it has nothing to do with the fact you're trying to kill the Doctor. It has to do with just your general presence. It's just so fucking oily. And you're such a gaslighting little motherfucker. I'm like, get the fuck away from her. Get away from her. But what I love, though, is that Tegan isn't fucking fooled by it.
No.
Do you know? She's just like, you suspicious son of a bitch. Also, the way he reacted to Adric's room, dude, get fucked.
Like, yeah.
Get fucked. In terms of his progress throughout the story, I do agree with you there, though, that, like, we are seeing him grow. I don't think that growth is entirely justified in the story, because all these two fuckers are doing is crawling around air ducts for 4 fucking episodes. Well, 3 mm-hmm. episodes. And then just wandering around corridors. He has no consideration for Tegan, really, at the beginning. Like, she's calling for help and he's just, like, trying to talk to the fucking crystal in his hand or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't see anything in the air ducts that would give him pause to have that conversation. It's not that they came across someone who'd been murdered and he saw, like, what the reality of that would look like. It's not like they knew Nissa was dying. They didn't know any of that. And so what I think the scene where he asked the question of could you kill someone, I think that was a really good scene. I think it was a little bit undeserved at that point.
No, I get you.
Because it's growth where we see him sort of level up, but we didn't see the path to get there other than him crawling around an air duct looking at Tegan's ass. Like, that's literally all we got. Do you know? And like I said, like, I think it would have been more impactful had they come across a dead body and someone who'd clearly been murdered. And he'd been like, fuck it, that's actually what I'm going to do. Like, what have I gotten myself into? Because between last episode and this episode, or like last, like Modern Undead and now, his main issue with not killing the Doctor is A, he's a bit weak-willed and he just doesn't want to get caught, like you said. But also, he hasn't had the opportunity. He was perfectly happy to fuck with the TARDIS and do all of this kind of stuff. He didn't give a shit. So, because he's just a selfish asshole. So for him to suddenly be asking that question, like I said, I just don't think it's earned. It's like, it would, I don't know why this is the thing that's coming to mind, but it would almost be like the Terminator from Terminator 1 at the end of that film sacrificing himself like the T-800 does in Terminator 2. What the fuck changed there? Why the sudden change of heart? Do you know what I mean? I don't think it was earned. I think it was a lovely scene. I don't think it was earned. And I think for all that Turlough is like the B plot of this, his quote unquote plot should have had more to flesh it out, because it really they could have condensed that down to 5 minutes
Yeah,
of
like
the
no,
two of them just wandering around.
I agree that like it is there's an awful lot of Die Hard in this, in the sense of like being stuck in the fucking vents and going between floors type thing. Like we've talked about it before where there's stuff that we have to put to our own imagination in order to kind of get the answers, and like part of it is lazy writing, part of it is to get conversation going, surrounding, you know, like fan discourse, things like that. And two things kind of popped into my head that would make Turlough raise that question outside of seeing a dead body. And one, like, I suppose it's, yeah, no, like, one is, so, okay, we know the Dark Guardian has said, like, I am evil, and the Doctor is the antithesis of me. And the only two things that happen in this story are that can make Turlough question, like, do I have the right to kill him? Is one, the Doctor willing to go into the unknown to find Nyssa by himself, and then the loyalty that the Doctor unintentionally, or maybe like doesn't want to, but the loyalty he inspires in Tegan to go and try and rescue them. And he's like, what sort of a man inspires this or does this? Type thing. That's the, but like again, that's pure conjecture on my part. And I do agree that parts of the story could have been trimmed to allow for the bigger growth for Turlough and also for something that happens at the end as well.
Yeah, I mean, even if, say, for example, they're crawling through the docks or what have you, and they see the doctor attack, there's nothing they can do to stop it, but they see it. And they have to keep going, so they don't know the outcome, or maybe they see that he's fine or whatever. Even that would be enough to justify the conversation. He sees someone attacking the doctor, he sees maybe Carrie stepping in, trying to defend him. Even the scene that did happen, so it was the end of, was it episode two? The scene that did happen where the doctor's, you know, being held with the thing, whatever, and Carrie shooting a man. If they had witnessed that scene, and he can see that this woman that the doctor just met like an hour ago, standing in to defend him and whatever, I was like, holy fuck. Like, even that, I think, would have added to what you're saying in that conversation later on, would have felt more justified. At the moment, though, right, brace yourself. I like him less than Stephen.
Okay, yeah, no, that's fine.
I do think he has potential, but he needs to fucking get going on that very fucking lively.
Yeah. And like I like we talked before about like the arc that Modron, this and the next story present. And I think we might get to that point next story. What I will say though is despite it all, really good performance by Mark Strickson here, I think.
Yeah. Sometimes I think it's a little bit overhyped, but the same is true of Sarah. I think it's just with this era of Doctor Who, I think some of the more emotional bits tend to be a little bit play-like a bit, if you get my drift. But everyone does it, so it's kind of equally balanced, if that makes sense.
No, it does. It does. So Tegan, the other part of this TNT twosome. So yeah, Tegan takes a very big backseat here to pretty much everything that's going on. But as I said, she takes the backseat, but it's to facilitate the the dispute of LaGrosse in Turlough's character, as we've seen in the story. Because no, don't get me wrong, right? Turlough's methodology, like as we said, look, last week he's an asshole. Here he's still an asshole, but it's interesting to see how his brain works. And as you said, like it's like Gaslight for Central, absolutely. But it's like last week, you know, he does the initial prank for like shits and giggles, and then he's like blaming it on Hippo, and it's like, okay, but like, is it just, you know, the schoolboy thing of like going, no, it wasn't me, it was him over there? Or is it actually the sort of like, well, I'm incredibly charming, I'm pretty sure I could convince you that it wasn't me, type guy, you know? But Tegan here is that she's just a facilitator for that growth. And like, I think Janet actually does those scenes quite well. The other kind of, suppose, big moments that she has are really shows how rickety that fucking transport ship is, because she merely slams her fist on the sensitive edge of the table and it manages to abort the launch sequence. I feel very sad for Tegan, though, because at the end, the last of her original attachments to the TARDIS are now gone. Because the Fourth Doctor is gone, Adric is gone, and now Nyssa is gone. Now, I know she only had the Fourth Doctor for one story, but that was the person that she knew. That was the person that she kind of like stood total. Yeah, I think she kind of stood side by side at the potential end of the universe with, you know? And at the end, I'm like, yeah, I'm totally on board with what the people, like you, the shippers, saw in relation to this, because like whatever hint you wanted to give about potentially the Doctor and Nyssa having some sort of a kind of attraction to each other, completely overshadowed by the dynamic chemistry between Janet and Sarah. It's like, yeah, here it's two people that love each other very much being forced to be separated. And yeah, so like, and then as I said, on top of like the really bad dynamic she has with the Doctor, I'm very curious to see how the rest of Tegan's run plays out. But yeah, so not a huge impact player here, but a good facilitator, I thought, for the story for Tegan.
I agree with you that Tegan is very much the lowest rung character of our standard set in the story. However, I love her in episode one. I love the fact that she's suspicious as fuck of Turlough. Because he's a suspicious fucking person.
Yep.
So of course she is. It's one of the things I love about Tegan is that she remembers shit from the last story.
Yeah.
Often people forget stuff that happened in the previous story. Tegan doesn't. Tegan fucking remembers shit. And so, like, she is immediately suspicious of him. He's acting suspicious. He's acting like a creep or whatever. I can only imagine how much it galled her to give him Adric's bedroom. And him talking about, like, oh, it looks like a child's room or whatever. And even, like, she takes Adric's slingshot with her. Like, again, it goes back to the fact that, like, Tegan may not smile all that often and may not be the most charming person on the fucking planet, but she feels very deeply. And my biggest worry for Tegan, you know, to your point of, you know, Nyssa's now gone. She is now in a situation, admittedly from our point of view, because in universe she doesn't really seem to, it doesn't seem to bother her that much. But from our point of view, she is now in a situation with a doctor who doesn't trust her and a companion that she doesn't trust.
Mm-hmm.
So if she goes to the doctor and says, I saw him touching the roundel before the crash, I saw this, I saw this, I saw this, I guarantee you, he won't fucking believe her. So
yeah,
she has someone who doesn't trust her and someone who she doesn't trust. And those are the two men that she is now traveling with. And that makes me feel a lot for her.
Mm-hmm.
Also, because of Turlough's actions, she has... Now, she doesn't know this yet, and when she does find out, I'm curious what her reaction will be. She has now lost Nyssa. Nyssa is now gone. And because she feels so deeply... Like, I think that's... I'm curious to see, and I better see that affect her next week. If they just brush it under the rug that Nyssa's gone, I'll be very disappointed. Because it's just, like... Their dynamic deserves better than that.
Mm.
One of the other things that really shone through about Tegan in this story was the fact that she's called Turlough weird when he's asking really bizarre fucking questions.
Mm-hmm.
But I love that throughout all of it, her dedication to Nyssa initially and then Nyssa and the Doctor together never falters.
No.
Tegan is a loyal fucking person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and like he said to stay in the TARDIS and she's like, fine. But then she's like, what's happening? And then she sees Nyssa's book outside and she's just like, oh my God. Like, she wants to help her friends. And that's the way she's been since Legopolis. She has been that way from the beginning. And I said, I loved how she stood up to Turlough. I want to see her stand up to the Doctor, but then I also kind of don't, because what kind of situation is that to be in where your whole life you're having to be defensive and or antagonistic or whatever. So
yeah.
I think Janet did a great job. I really wish, like, fuck the Doctor's conversation with what's-his-face, fucking Valgard or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to hear Nyssa and Tegan's conversation. Because you see it just working out in the background. You know, Nyssa's like, Tegan, I want to talk to you. They're having a silent conversation. Tegan starts turning to go get the Doctor. And Nyssa's pulling her back to continue their conversation. And Tegan's just like, oh my God, dude, you have to convince her because she's going, what the fuck?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I loved that scene. And I wanted that conversation. I didn't give a monkey's about what was happening in the foreground. I wanted to hear mm-hmm. the conversation in the background. Because I can only imagine what Janet and Sarah were saying to each other.
Pints.
In the background.
Pints.
Do you know? So yeah, I think for the role that she had, I think she did really well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm concerned about being left the only companion now, like, with these two. I agree with you. Anyone who has seen beyond this point, or even if you've only been following along and even watching the episodes with us, and so you're only at this point, but you like Tegan and the Doctor's dynamic, please fucking let us know why.
Mm-hmm.
Like, please. Because we don't get it.
Yeah. Jesus Christ, even in the Daleks, the Doctor was like, I'm beginning to think I misjudged you.
Yeah. Okay. And then the lady herself.
Mm.
Nyssa of Trachin.
Mm-hmm. At least she ended on a high note, that's what I'll say. She wasn't shunted off with some lover that she met 25 minutes ago. And to be fair, like, I think throughout the whole story, she's a very positive element in it. I mean, like, she gives the cowardly lion his courage, she finds the tin man a heart, and gives the scarecrow his brain. And, like, I'm not a million miles off in that assessment, because she ends up with a giant 8-foot-tall fucking Toto at the end of the story. Cowardly lion being Alvear, tin man being Valgard, and scarecrow being Boar. because by helping him get like the hydromel again, he regains his like
cognitive function.
Thank you very much. There we go. I'm not gonna lie to you. When I said like, "Oh my god, Cowardly Lion, Tin Man," I was going like, "Who the Scarecrow? Who the fuck is the Scarecrow? I can't have only two of this trio." yeah. No, but like seriously, Nyssa is a huge driving point in this story, and yes, she is the damsel in distress that everyone is trying to locate. Her interaction with everyone in this yields some sort of positive result for the end of the story. Like, Alvear is basically, he's sitting in the corner fucking wanting to get away from it all. And in the end, he actually is a huge dynamic part of the story. She helps unlock Valgard's, or like take down Valgard's cynicism about the whole fucking case of affairs just by talking to him. The whole thing. And then it's like the minute she gets cured, her whole focus is, well, this could be done better. This could be done better. This could be done better. Like it's, her thought is like of all the infected that are still on the ship and that are still probably in transit to this fucking place as of that thing. And like, as the doctor said, to stay behind on a leper colony, which is what it is like, to stay behind in that sort of a situation where they don't have the right, the equipment isn't up to standard, a lot of the guards and everyone else that wants to help her are sick, she has a lot of work to do. That's fucking tough. Like, you mentioned Stephen before, like, and Stephen, yeah, like, he was left in the, like, trying to help rebuild the society, being, and God help that society, that's all I'm going to say here. Here, it's like, I actually think this is probably one of the better companion write-outs, because she's not just fobbed off on someone. Yeah. She's gone to serve a purpose. You know?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, so in terms of the story as a whole, so Nyssa is the damsel in distress in the story, by the very nature of it.
Mm-hmm.
But she has a bit of like Sarah Jane in Genesis of the Daleks, where she's like trying to figure out what the fuck is happening.
Mm-hmm.
She's paying attention to everything. She's building so many of these connections with everybody, particularly with Oliver, I think was lovely. And I'm so glad they didn't go down a romantic route with that, because no, that wouldn't have been good. But what I love is that Nyssa ends the story the same way she began. She's a scientist. This is what she does. Mm-hmm. Do you know? And in many ways, traveling with the doctor has allowed her to, you know, flesh out her skills and do whatever. But she never gets to actually see the outcome of the stuff that she does.
Mm-hmm.
Really? And I love the fact that, again, like, Nyssa is someone who feels very deeply. We can tell she's a very emotional person. Like, she is quite, mm-hmm. she's a bit of a screamer. Do you know, she cries out and blah, blah, blah. I love that her decision to stay is completely her own. I think of the companion being left behind on an alien planet or whatever, I think it is the most well-earned.
Mm-hmm.
Like, ever. Like, if you think all the way back to Susan didn't get a choice. Vicky, we didn't get to see it on screen, and that was a stupid love thing, which makes no sense.
Mm-hmm.
Jumping ahead, we have Stephen, who got a similar in concept
sent off. But he didn't earn it.
Completely unearned. And it was kind of just handed to him. Mm-hmm. Who else left after that? So we would have had...
I think he's the last one. Like, you have
Romana too is probably the only other one.
Yeah.
I would say this is done better than that.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the Romana 2 exit was kind of earned. You know, I'll give her that credit. But I think this was done better because you can see her questioning it from the get-go. The minute Albeer explains to her what this place is, she's questioning it. And, as she's recovering, she's just like, oh my god, this actually works, but holy fuck, what they've been doing. Like, just randomly fucking exposing people. And the fact that she recognized that Garm knew what he was doing, he just wasn't being given the control to do it properly, I thought was really good. Do you know that she recognized that? Because I have a bit talk about Garm later on, where the character kind of confused me a bit, but I thought that was really great. I loved her goodbye. I actually quite liked her goodbye with the doctor. I think, again, if you look at the doctor and Nyssa in isolation, they have a really good dynamic, and I really quite enjoy it. I quite enjoy watching it. It's only when you then compare it to other dynamics, it just seems like a bit like, what the fuck is this? And I loved her dynamic with Tegan. The fact that she was like, I'll be fine because I'm just as because I'm like you, I'm indestructible, which isn't her saying like, I'm just as good as you are. It's her saying, Tegan, you're amazing. This fucker never tells you that, but I will. Do you know? Which I thought was great. I was devastated. I genuinely did not know that's what this episode was. And when I realized she was staying behind, I was like, what? What? No. What are you doing? Like,
Success, success. This has yielded success.
and like, it's not often that I go into an exit like this completely blind, because usually you and I will discuss it at a high level or something of, oh, next week we'll be talking about such and so's last episode or whatever. And just the way the last few weeks have gone, you and I haven't had that conversation, and I haven't had the time to, because sometimes I might prepare bits of the trivia notes before I watch it, just because I haven't had the time to do that. I literally did the trivia this morning. So I was completely blindsided by it. I will miss Nyssa as a character. I really enjoyed her. I thought Sarah was brilliant. I'm gutted that Nyssa isn't cited more. Do you know? Like,
She's
when people talk about like classic companions that are really good, like, Nyssa's up there for me. Like, we'll talk about it a bit more next week when we're doing her rambling, but like, she's up there. I really liked her.
Gets lost in the shuffle an awful lot, which is a shame, like, because she's a really good character. And you said something there that I thought was interesting was about Romana 2's ending being earned. And I think they're earned in kind of two different ways, because Romana 2's ending was the culmination of a character's growth away from like the stuffiness of the Time Lord Society to being like a doctor-esque protege going off into E space and doing the work of the doctor. Nyssa's one is she's actually kind of come full circle, because as you pointed out, she started off as a scientist, she's ending as a scientist. But also, what was she doing in Keeper of Tracking? Was she was tending to the afflicted, to the, she was tending to the Melkor. Here, she's doing the same, although granted, like this is for a much more positive side of things. And so it's, yeah, she's kind of started. She finished where she started, but it's her growth in the actual title that she's in, the role that she's
But
in,
also,
is
she grew
great.
from being a child
Yeah.
to now being a fully blown woman who makes her own decisions and
And
wears a
like,
really short skirt.
yeah. And as well, like it is consistent throughout the team, because if you remember back to the visitation, how she was upset that she had to destroy the android, you know, because like, oh, he could have been amazing to get to know him and study him and like learn what he knew type thing. So it's like her and she now gets to kind of do that with Garm. Because and as well, like with she gets to do that with Garm, and if you think about it, the Vanir are maybe like the tenders from back on Tracking, so she gets to kind of try and bring the best of what was Tracking into this situation, I think. And I'm very curious to see if there's expanded lore for Nyssa only stories in this new situation.
I think there is. Like I said, I didn't go too much into it because I just had a look on the TARDIS wiki, I did look up Nyssa as a character, and I do think there is expanded media because Sarah Sutton didn't do a lot of acting after Doctor Who, but she did reprise the character of Nyssa in a lot of audio stories. And I think there's been like novels and like extra media of her time after, because in the TARDIS wiki there is like her children get mentioned, for example, in her
Oh,
bio,
cool.
in her
Perfect.
bio
All right,
chart. So
so
there is something
I
there.
need to
I
follow.
would suggest like to explore the TARDIS wiki entry for Nyssa, because there's a lot of like, obviously because of Big Finish and whatever, there's a lot of stories of just the Doctor and Nyssa traveling together between Time Flight and Arc of Infinity. There's more stories of the Doctor, Nyssa and Tegan traveling together before they pick up Turlough. Like, so there's a lot of filler stories there. Some of which are just the Doctor and Nyssa, which I'm quite curious about now. And obviously there is mention in later stories of Tegan and Nyssa being a thing. So, you know, need to get to that point in the expanded media. Where did that happen? But yeah, I will miss Nyssa as a character. I think she's been really good.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely one of the highlights of this era.
Yeah. Okay, then we have our vast prominent characters. So we've Carrie and Oliver, Irak and Valgard, and then Sigurd and Bor.
Bor and
Then we
Garm.
have Garm. Yeah, so Sigurd and Bor kind of put together,
Yeah.
and
Oh,
then
so, oh,
Garm.
yeah.
And then we'll get to the Black Guardian, who I don't know if we have much to talk about him, but he is the only villain, really.
Yeah, like I have like I think maybe one or I think one thing to say about him, and that's it. But we'll see, we'll see. You actually kind of made a good point there of the pairing units, Carrie, Oliver. I'm happy to speak about them as pairs, if you yeah, because this is one of those things of where there's an awful lot of prominent characters that deserve something to be said about them, but not enough to have that individual conversation, I don't think. So, we start off with Sigurd and Bor first. Cool. So, it's like, okay with Sigurd. I think his initial portrayal was like he was like this superior-esque prison guard, and but then as the story progressed, it's like he's. I think he's meant to represent like the core of the rest of the Vanir, which is that they all kind of care. But they're just fucking jaded. And like that to me is backed up by the evidence, like where when he finds out that Nyssa can help give them hydromel so that they can be stronger to do their duties, and also like there won't be repercussions from the company, he's like, I'm on board, I'll help. And it kind of raised the question, like, I'd love to know like where, because like no, I'll get to Valgard's thing, all right, but were they conscripted into this? Were they, was it a job offer? Whatever it was that brought them here in the first place, I think over time he became jaded, and as the sicker he got, and the less healthy people he saw leaving, I think like a lot of them, he just represents the cynicism that they all went through, but I think. But I think Bor is the more interesting one of the duo, because he's someone that hasn't, to like in my watching of it, he's someone that hasn't lost that caring edge, because he's willing to go into the quarantine zone, thereby potentially risking himself further, and then he spends, we don't know how long, but this quantity of time scavenging for materials to try and block off radiation leak, exposing himself to almost certain death, and he doesn't stop. And it's to like prevent the thing from going up. But if he's as jaded as everyone else, why shouldn't it go all up, you know? And but then I actually kind of realized, wait, no, in his lucid state, he talked about the Big Bang, so he might have been trying to prevent that as well. But again, it's he's trying to protect. That's his thing. He views himself as a protector. So I actually quite enjoyed Bord. I'm glad that he didn't die. Glad that he was saved.
I'm glad Bord was saved as well. My thing with the two of them was, I was trying to find a way to classify them, because initially I was like, are we going to talk about them or not? I think in many ways, Sigurd is like the heart of what the Vanir are meant to be. Do you know? He clearly is dedicated. He clearly cares for Bor. Do you know what I mean? Like, he would never just stand aside and let him die. Do you know? He clearly believes in what they're doing. It's just like you said, he's jaded and tired and clearly doesn't like the way things are being run, but is like, what the fuck am I meant to do? I can't do anything against it. Do you know what I mean? But I think if Sigurd is the heart of the way the Vanir are meant to be, Bor's the soul.
Yeah.
Of who they are. And he has kept that. Like you said, like, everything that he was willing to do, but also just the way he looks at the situation. He's not angry. He's not bitter. He's just like, I'm doing everything I can to do this. And the others rally to, like, Sigurd rallies to him. Do you know? Like, he's not going to give up on him. And he's the type of guy that inspires that sort of dedication. Also, I think the way Bor sees Garm is very different to the way the others have started to see him. Like, Bor clearly still remembers and cares about what Garm is meant to be doing. Do you know? And who Garm is and what Garm is for. And I think I'm really glad he didn't die. I did think all the time that he was sort of waxing poetic. That was how that was going to end. And I'm really glad it didn't. But I think, like, together, like, the way I sort of look at it, you know, going forward, and we'll talk about Valgard in a second, is that Valgard is the strength. Sigurd is the heart, and Bor's the soul.
Like, yeah.
The three of them together, with Nissa as the brains of the outfit. Like you said, you were kind of doing like the Cowardly Lion and all that kind of stuff. In a way, we kind of have that in these three as well.
Yeah.
Do you know? I think in many ways you could swap out Sigurd for, or Alvir for Sigurd in the description you were giving earlier.
Yeah. No, I just realized that there, because when you see with that vial of Hydromel and he's like, yes, I'll help. It is like, yeah, the line be giving his courage back again.
When Eric steps in, you know, Sigurd is immediately like, no, I'm siding with Valgard. I'm siding. This is what we're doing. Do you know? So yeah, I think the two of them together, I think, are a really good dynamic. And I think they will help elevate Valgard to be who he can be.
Yeah. Cool. What is the Vanaheim version of Valhalla called? That big, huge fucking... I call it the Summer Hut.
I don't remember.
Because I think that's essentially what they'll turn Terminus into.
I'm trying to remember. I can just think of it from Magnus Chase. Folkvanger.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
I think they're just going to turn it into Terminus into that side of things.
Yeah.
So I think the next pairing are probably Alvir and Kari.
That's true.
Yeah. So Kari, she's just really the Doctor's assistant in this story. Like, she's his extra pair of hands, because there's nothing really from her that either drives plot, adds exposition, or helps motivate another character. She's just kind of there. Whereas Alvir, as I said, actually, my apologies, I used the wrong analogy when I was talking about Turlough. It's Alvir's journey that reminds me of Finn, not Turlough's.
Yeah. I was wondering for a second.
Yeah, I was there. No, because like, I had the note and I was going, because there's two people that I, at the time I said went through character growth, Turlough and Alvear. It's Alvear's what I meant in terms of The Last Jedi. So apologies in relation to that point. But no, it does kind of remind me like Finn's arc in The Last Jedi, because he goes from wanting to run away from everything to risking his life to find Nissa. And he doesn't stop. He never gets deterred. He shoots Garm and the weapons don't work. And he still goes after her. He fights Valgard and loses his weapon. And he still goes after her. And he encounters Garm again, like unarmed and without Nissa in between as a sort of a distraction. So I was really, really interested in his story, and I like seeing his dynamic with this, excuse me, with Nissa throughout this whole thing. And I'm actually kind of annoyed at how this story ends for them. It's left on a cliffhanger. It's just like, they're like, how will we get off the station? And then she goes, and Carrie goes, yeah, about that. And it's like, real missing. It's like... I hope it's fucking addressed in the next story, like the guys at the end of Earthshock, because at least it was said like, oh yeah, we dropped them all off. But yeah, I think of the two of them, Alvear is the more noteworthy one here.
Yeah, I think for me it's interesting. Like, I remember when they first came through, all I could think was the Sarah Brightman song, "I Lost My Heart to a Starship Trooper." Because they're dressed so flamboyantly. I also was thinking, because obviously, as mentioned previously, we're watching X-Men 97, of the Shi'ar priestess, empress, whatever.
Oh, Lalandra.
Yeah. And her initial bug-like headpiece.
Spacesuit, yeah.
Because those helmets, man, Jesus Christ. I mean... you get stuck in a door in that thing.
Mm.
Like, this story was made in the 80s. Like, just a standard one would do. Like, it's not like they have big ears or something that need to become... I don't know. It's fucking stupid.
They had better spacesuits in the 60s.
Yeah, like it makes no sense. Anyway, I agree with you in everything you said about Carrie versus Alvear, because although Carrie is the leader of the group... she knows nothing. She's not providing any information. Alvear is the one who's providing the info dump to Nissa. Carrie is just there. If anything, I would say Carrie's main purpose in the story, other than to kick off the Doctor and Nissa part of the plot, the on the ship part of the plot, Carrie's role in the story is to be the Doctor's defense and weapon when needed. And to be someone that he can talk to, because Nissa isn't there. And he's talking to.
I just imagine like the Doctor kind of going, right, here's how we're going to do this. Nissa, you go and try and figure out what's going on here with this machine. Alvear, you go and protect her. Carrie, you stand over there and look sexy with a gun.
It's like, you know, Nissa, go do this. Alvear, go protect her. You know, I'm going to stay here and do this. Carrie, stay here, protect me. No, she's nice, don't get me wrong. She's nice. Like,
yeah, yeah.
She doesn't really do anything. Alvear is the interesting one because, like, he clearly is ashamed when he runs away, you know, and he just sits in a corner and cries. And even that he won't come out and face Carrie, who we've seen isn't exactly, like, an evil leader person, no. You know. But the fact that he grows this connection with Nissa, and then Nissa gets taken, and he's just like, well, shit. And it is a kind of a classic journey of, like, coward to hero type thing that we've seen in a lot of media. But I think he does it quite well. And I just find it funny that throughout all of it, he's just in this most flamboyant outfit.
Mm-hmm.
With the most flamboyant hair, and I'm just like sweetheart.
the disco version of the Star Wars team is playing every time he swings into action.
Yeah, like, it's It's okay. Okay, my love. Like, no problem. I am surprised at one thing, with Oliver, which is when he asks Carrie how they're going to get home. Because the way his story was projecting, I thought he would want to stay and be like that other protector. Like, so you've got like Valgard and his group doing their job and, you know, helping process the people through and whatever, and then Olvir is there to protect Nyssa, and to see that, like, this nightmare fuel that he was clearly so terrified of, to help make that better. But then if he offered to stay, then where does Carrie go? Because obviously she wasn't being kept on as a companion.
Because, like, we talked about, like, A, B, and C plots. There's actually a D plot here of where, like, they're rebels against some sort of galactic fucking company thing that's going on in the background. So, like, we're like, all right, cool, fair enough. They could have just been space raiders. It would have been as perfectly simple.
Okay, so then we have Arrak and, in my mind, the more prominent of the two, Valgard.
So, Eric, do you know what he reminds me of? He's like that typical company guy of where it's like, yeah, these people are, like the bosses are shafting us and all this type of stuff. But meanwhile, at the same time, completely towing the company line when it's like, because he's a person in charge, he's like, I hope they don't fire me. But like, wants to have his kind of cake and eat it type scenario. And like, at one point, I thought he was lying about the fake hydromel, but then I went and I rewatched the scene, and he's like, "Oh no, like it is legitimately just piss water." Because I thought he might have switched it out, but then I switched to thinking that no, he's literally he's hoarding it, and he gives first dibs to himself, because when Sigurd says that Bor is dying, and he needs hydromel, or he'll die without it, then your man just goes like, "Well, then like." Why should we detain him from dying? And again, it's like the whole callous thing of it's not putting him out of his misery, it's like more hydromel for me. So yeah, like he's just a typical company guy, He think like he doesn't I think he cares more about numbers than he does care about people, the people associated with those numbers, Whereas Valgard, now, first of all, that actor always reminds me of a werewolf mid-transition because his mouth is, it's like he has an underbite and an overbite at the same time. So it's, and plus, like, with his pale skin and his, like, frazzled grey hair, he is like a werewolf coming here. But it was interesting to see, like, that. I used the thing before, but, like, all the Vanir are jaded, but he's got he's a very decent core to him, because again, like as it goes on, like no, initially he's like, are you? She said, are you doctors? He's like, we're more like bloody baggage handlers at this stage, because they're not seeing the results of what's going on. And then he's like, what's the point of us trying to fucking do anything? It's not going to work. We're all just getting sicker, and as it goes on. But then it's like he more focuses on, it's not the hydromel that he focuses on. It's what can be done if they have the continuous supply of hydromel. We can go back to the way things were. So I think he's very, he's the muscle, but also he's got a good heart to him as well, I think. He seems like a decent, he reminds me of Tyler in Dalek's Invasion of Earth. He's like the resistance fighter who's seen so many people die, and he's lost an awful lot of friends, and he's like, why the fuck do I keep fighting? But at the same time, he never gives up the fight. As well, the other thing was, I was wondering if he was putting on the story about being a former rebel fighter, because we know that like that whole thing was a distraction to try and get Olvir closer to him so he could fucking knock him out. But was the story fake as well? Because he's clearly cunning enough to fucking try and get someone to lower their guard.
I don't think the story was fake,
All right.
because he knew too much for it to be fake. I also, I think the other reason why I don't think the story was fake is that I think what happened to Carrie and Oliver, where they are attacking a ship because of the cargo, and then suddenly they get left behind. I think that's exactly what happened to him.
Well, I thought that initially too, but then I realized that maybe the ship left because they realized that that was a leper ship.
Well, because he was saying that he was given up for to the company for like the
Yeah.
reward or something. So I think it's the exact same thing. I think
Okay, fair enough.
that whoever the captain is, I've forgotten the name they mentioned, contacted the company and was like, I'll give you two of my people for cash. And that they staged this whole thing because who in their right mind would agree to go there? Because they thought that like that the cargo there was some precious cargo and whatever. And with no communications, no nothing, your man just left. I think the same thing happened to him. But yeah, I think with Eric and Lagarde, so Eric in particular reminded me of a cross between two different people from the Aliens franchise. He reminded me of a cross between Dallas and Burke in the sense that Dallas was a bit of a shithead, if we're honest, right? In the way that he treated Ripley, he was the leader, he was the commander, everyone followed him. He did co toe the company line, but he also enjoyed his own little bit of power where he was, to the point of when someone's like, hey, this is against the policy, you know, whatever, he's like, I'm in charge, fucking do what I tell you.
And it wasn't even just with Ripley as well, like the way that he would treat Parker and
Like
Brett.
he clearly saw himself as better. And like I said, even which sort of shadows the way that Eric behaves with the Lazars, but even like the way he is with Valgard would be very similar to the way he is with Ripley. Or even the way he was with Sigurd would be the way that he was with Ripley. And then the other side is Burke, which is 100% company man. Willing to sacrifice everyone and anything to get what he wanted, you know, like you said, like with Bor, well, he's going to die anyway, so why prolong his death? Just, you know, don't give him, we need this, is very similar to Burke in Aliens, and this whole idea of, well, you know, the little girl was going to die anyway, so let's just smuggle back whatever. I am curious how he rose to be the rank of leader amongst these people. Like, I kind of get the impression that, like, he's probably one of the few people who were going there was maybe actually his choice. Do you know? But maybe, like, the company kind of lied to him about what the job would be or something.
This is the one I wouldn't mind reading the novelization to see if there's any little inner monologues for a lot of the characters.
Then we have Valgard, though, who, to be honest, like literally from the first minute I saw him, I was like, it's the Hound. That's what it is. He is the Hound from Game of Thrones. He even kind of looks like him a little bit, I think.
He does. Yeah, he's got that weird Rory McCann over underbite going on,
Yeah. I think he is. I do quite believe my theory that what happened to Carrie and Oliver is what happened to him. I do think he was left behind to be a guard of this area. I think he's become so fucking bitter and twisted about everything, which is like every day, day in, day out, we see these sick people. You can't even fucking talk to them. They're beyond death in many ways. And I just shovel them down to Garm and I never see what happens afterwards. For all I know, they just get chucked into a fucking black hole. And, like, he seems to be very angry at everything. Because, like, he seems to be very much up for a fight, but I think that's just, he's just so frustrated. Like, when he sees the doctor and Carrie and Oliver, and he's like, the fucking hunt is on. Because something is going wrong. And in his mind, these people are from the fucking company and this is all their fucking fault. But the minute he realizes that, hold on, you can do what? Okay, no. I will support that. I will lead that. No problem. I got your man on tape a while ago saying that he'd give me full control, so let's play ball with that. And like, you see him smiling. You see him being genuine towards the end. Is he an asshole? Yeah. But like I said, it's kind of in the same way that the Hound is. Mm-hmm. I sort of see, like, in many ways, Volgard and Nyssa is kind of like the Hound in Arya, except over a much more condensed time frame.
Yeah.
Do you know? And I do think he'll work really well with the other two.
Mm-hmm.
Eric, I think, should just be kicked off into a black hole or something. Fuck him.
Yeah.
Spark.
You're on sanitation duty for the rest of your life.
Fuck him, he's an asshole.
So then we have Garm. He's so fluffy. Like, seriously though, like, who wouldn't want a big cuddle from a monster that is essentially a hospice worker? Apart from Vikings that didn't have an honourable debt. But at the same time, I quite liked Garm because he wasn't just the big boogeyman monster. He's actually very empathetic. He legitimately cares for the infected because he cradles them. Like, that's the, he doesn't just throw them over his shoulder like a sack of potatoes or anything like that. He actually cradles everyone that he carries. And his thing of, like, where we're talking to Oliver, going, like, the treatment, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. I'm treating them the best I can. And, like, he's just like, he wants to save them, but he's been hampered by for so long. So when the doctor finally frees him, I'm like, I really hope that this isn't the thing of where, like, you know, he dies as a result of being free. You know, like that he's like, because like, you never quite know, is he a robot or is he actually a long-lived actual being, you know? So I really, really enjoyed Garm. I don't know, like, I don't know, he's not in it a whole lot, but for the scenes that he's there, he's kind of impactful. He reminds me of the Hermit character from the Rybos operation. You know, he's there to kind of get over the emotional aspect of the story. And thankfully, as I said, he didn't die. I think he hit all the right notes for the character that he was meant to, for the part that he was meant to play.
Mm. For me, he kind of reminds me of a cross between, going back to our mythologies, I'm jumping Rowden verse again to the Cain Chronicles.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep forgetting her name. She is a giant hippo.
Tarot or Tarot.
Tarot. Yep.
Yeah.
He reminds you of a cross between Tarot and Agador.
Yeah.
From Monster and Curse of Paladon.
I can see that.
The thing about Gorm for me is, I agree with everything you said. Gorm just confuses me.
Garm.
Garm. Sorry, I keep saying Gorm. Garm just confuses me because the sort of slave controller thing, is that because Garm is immune to radiation? Is it because Garm came up with the treatment? I'm thinking it's the former, because Nyssa said that he can't really control it because he's only doing what the control caller is telling him, and he can't use his own intuition to do whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you that, like, he clearly cares a lot, and I was kind of half waiting for, like, his eyes to turn, like, blue or something when the controller was destroyed. But yeah, I think he's a character I want to know more about, because, like, how did he get there? Again, you know, is it something like he's from a species that's immune to radiation, and so the company kidnapped him or whatever to put him in this position? And, you know, unlike the others, he hasn't really lost his dedication to what it is he's doing.
Mm. Or was he part of the original crew of Terminus Station that survived the time jump?
Yeah. The other thing about him that confuses me is, and this is a criticism of the story as a whole, because I think I missed something. So he takes them into whatever, he irradiates them. Whatever. Sometimes they survive, and he puts them into a room to decontaminate. Then what does he do with them? Because this is the big question of people go to Garm, but they don't come back. So what does he do?
Like,
Like, I had a
part of me
horrible
was.
suspicion that the dead people were turned into the Hydromel. Like, for the first like 2 episodes, I thought
Yeah.
that
Hydromel is people.
was happening. Exactly. But I don't know. Like, I don't like, because that's clearly what Carrie was referring to at the end, was that they would leave in the same way Garm has been freeing people. But if Garm was actually curing people and sending them somewhere, then surely Olvir's fear of Terminus would be negated because the survivors would have told people that they survived.
I actually have a theory just popped into my head there. So maybe in the early days, the success rate was higher and word got out then. And then when the success rate started to lower, maybe those that survived actually became Vanir and took over those duties until the success rate plummeted, that they actually had to fucking hire Vanir outside and send him to Terminus. And
Maybe.
this is just the first one to survive in a long time.
Maybe. I don't know. That was just a bit that confused me. I do like Garm, though. Like I said, he's like a cross between Agador and Tarot.
Also, I actually quite enjoyed Tarat's version in Moon Knight.
We
I
talked about
thought
this
she
a few
was.
weeks ago in work. Yeah.
I quite enjoyed her in Moon Knight.
I
Quite
do
enjoyed
want to
Moon
see the
Knight.
Magus chase Tarot, though,
Oh, yeah,
in live action.
absolutely.
I think
In
that
her
would,
big
or like animated would be good too.
nurse's outfit.
Yeah, she's so good.
So we'll move on to the villain, if you want to even fucking call him that, for this story. The only thing I have to say about the Black Guardian in this, sorry, no, I tell you, two things. One is, for the whole story, he's Doctor Who's version of the Emperor Palpatine "do it" meme. That's all he is the entire time. It's just "do it, do it, do." On the more serious side of things, though, it's interesting to see that he seemingly cannot control free will.
Yeah.
Like, so that was like, I was going, because it looked like he was able to do it in the last story. Granted, it didn't last very long. So maybe, he placeboed fucking Thurlow into thinking that. But it looks like he can't actually impose himself on free will. So, next story is actually going to be very interesting to see Thurlow, how Thurlow interacts with him.
I have two things as well. One, I think we're seeing here more and more this whole with the free will thing, like the only thing he can get from you is your agreement. And he can torture the shite out of you to get you to follow your agreement, but that's really all it is. It's an agreement to do something. And the second thing is, dude, your plan isn't working.
Yeah, and also while
You
you're
are
at it,
waste you're wasting your fucking energy with this guy, because it's just not gonna work.
and while you're coming up with a new plan, get that fucking crow off your head.
Yeah, I think as a villain, he's a bit shit, to be honest. I think his later idea and concept, which is the trickster, like, the trickster's fucking creepy. And like how he manipulates and how he plays with things. This guy's just like, I will try to be like the trickster. No, and so I'm going to twirl my crow head thing and be like, mwah, ha, ha. I was just like, oh, for God's sake.
JNT, can we get the trickster? We have the trickster at home. It's called the Black Guardian.
It's like the Wish version of the
Yeah,
trickster, or like the
exactly.
Temu version or something.
Fucking hell. And there's only one person that can pull off a decorative carrion bird hat, and that's Professor Snape. Okay, it's Alan. It's Alan Rickman. No one else. So, Terminus on Terminus, if you will. I managed to pull that joke off twice. Once last week and once this week. So, at this point of the episode, myself and Trish gave our final thoughts on the story, and we each give the rating out of 5. So, surprise, surprise, I had a very good time watching the story. The cliffhangers were very good. While not being the exact same, they did give me a Hinchcliffe era vibe, because they were all of like, they were like, okay, you have the Soylent Green as people esque, you know, we're on a leper ship, and then there's your Valgar attacking the Doctor, and then there's the, oh my god, we're all going to die in a big universal catastrophic, you know, flip the switch thing, you know. So like, it kind of brought me back to some of the Barry Letts, Philip Hinchcliffe era cliffhangers. I enjoyed the B plot of Die Hard on a spaceship. And the A plot, such as like, so the Doctor trying to rescue Nyssa, it introduced some really good characters and the themes that we've been talking about, of like the representation of what characters are, the emotional aspect, and seeing Nyssa's growth. As I said, this was Turlough and Nyssa's story. And like, the main issue was just kind of floating around them, and it was building off of them and their interactions as it went on. So I really enjoyed that, really did. And good performances from the supporting cast. And I can't stress enough how much I enjoyed that Nyssa had a good ending that was earned. Huge, huge impact for me on this. The biggest drawbacks were, again, the Doctor's weird fucking relationship with Tegan. I just don't get it. I really don't. And it's, I don't know if I've used this expression before, but now it's actually fucking me off. It just fucking sucks the last. I was there going, yay, oh, boo, fuck it. So it kind of sucks the emotion me out of that side of things. The other main detractor I have for this story was the very rushed ending. Because what's going to happen with Carrie and Oliver? How does the power struggle going to work out? Because like, seemingly it's just like, I've got to stop you here while you have your little spat. Can you please bring me to the engine? Meanwhile, en route to the engine. So you're in charge, because presumably kicked Eric in the dick off screen or something, and managed to do it that way. But to be fair, like, those were the two biggest drawbacks. There's a potential drawback here, but it can't really impact the scoring, is how is next episode going to start with the ending being focused on Turlough and the Black Guardian? Like, is it going to reprise, or are we just going to get a whole, well, that was a very strange half hour while we managed to solve world leprosy type fucking shit. But overall, really enjoyed this. Really enjoyed the second time watching it for the character notes. I'm giving this a 4 out of 5. I had a really enjoyable time watching the story.
Not bad. Let me go to my little tracker. Let me find you. 4 out of 5. Cool. I didn't enjoy this as much as you did. I found it really hard to get into once the Lazars are lepers story started. So for like episode 1, I was quite into, and then episode 2 kind of lost me for a bit, and then there's so much unexplained about how Terminus works. I found it a bit difficult to keep myself focused on what's happening. Like the fact that I did think that they were turning the Lazards into that green shit until they explained that no, it came from the gummies. Oh, okay, cool. So I found that a bit difficult. I did like Nyssa in this. I did like Tegan. I wasn't a big fan of the Die Hard bit because the Die Hard bit went on for three fucking episodes, which was not fucking needed. Like, have them do something else, have them meet up with everyone else. I think that was just lazy writing, to be honest. But I, by the end of the story, I was actually quite vested into it. So it lost me around the middle and then it picked up again at the end. I do still have all those same questions though around where the fuck was Garm sending people when he cured them? Like, how the fuck were they getting anywhere? How did this whole thing start in the first place? All that kind of stuff. The doctor was fine. And up until that point, like I was saying, I think part of the reason I struggled with this is actually a Peter Davison thing. I find, I don't know if you have this problem, with the previous doctors, I had this a little bit with Patrick as well, but not as much. I find it hard to find their techno babble. Oh no, with all the previous doctors, bar maybe Patrick in some stories, I never found it hard to find their techno babble believable and to get invested in the scientific aspect of what they were doing. With Peter, though, and I was thinking about it today, this has been true since he started. I don't know if it's just the way he expresses himself or whatever. His techno babble never sounds believable. It often sounds like he's just saying words in a script and he's not actually describing what it is or the impact. And sometimes I think his tone doesn't match what it should, and it makes it difficult for my brain to engage with what the fuck he's talking about.
So the way that I describe it to people, or the way I would describe it to people if they ever pose that question to me, because you're the first person that's posed that question to me, is I think Peter's outfit is, to me, is a perfect representation of his doctor. It is so fucking beige with flashes of bright color, flashes of orange trim. There have been some great Peter moments. They really have. But at the same time, there's an awful lot of fucking beige. Like, to the like, there are some times where I watch stories where I'm like, what did he actually do in this story? Like what made it so, or like, even if he didn't, even if he wasn't like the one that was solving the plot, like, where was the bigging up of another character? Where was driving something else along, you know?
Yeah, so, but I find that with him in general, like particularly with the techno babble, it just doesn't come across as believable. Like, a lot of the Star Trek actors, and even like with Star Wars as well, I know Mark Hamill has told the story a million times over of like, you can write this shit. It's really hard to say it. And I don't think Peter says it well. He doesn't sell the science. Sarah sold it. Sarah Sutton, I totally believed her. Every time Nyssa would talk about something, I totally believed what she was doing. I don't believe him though, and that makes stories like this where the technology or the science is the framework for what's happening. It makes it hard for my brain to lock into it.
But see, you've said the thing about, like, bringing up Patrick, like, so yeah, there are times it's hard to lock onto the techno babble, but the rest of your brain then is distracted by his presence, his energetic performance as that cosmic hobo side of things. Here, unfortunately, just for me, and as evidenced by you, Peter isn't hooking us in the same way as the others have.
He's just a bit bland. And sadly, when he's not being bland, he's being an asshole to Tegan. For no fucking reason. Like, if I was her, I would have smacked him in the face in Power of the Doctor as well.
Absolutely, like, absolutely. But we're now, just before you give your score, to reiterate, we're now moving into an era that doesn't have Nyssa, it doesn't have Adric, it has brand new waters for this doctor going into. So let's see if he's able to sink or swim. But back to
Back
Terminus.
to me. It's Nissa's last story, and I didn't know, and the title probably should have given it away, but it didn't. And I wasn't expecting it. I think this is the best companion goodbye we've had since Sarah Jane.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
It's earned. It was that once it's earned over the story. That one scene is well performed, if you ignore the start of it. That one scene is well performed. It makes sense for the character. It's touching, it's emotional. It's the one scene where actually I did believe Peter, actually. It's probably the one scene where I saw some bit of emotion from him. And I thought it was well deserved. And I think it's the best goodbye story we've had since Sarah Jane. And to be honest, you and I have said this before, a lot of times the goodbyes in Doctor Who are a bit fucking shit.
Absolutely.
We haven't had that many good ones.
I think you can probably count on one hand the good ones.
And for me, I think the two best goodbyes, and this just happens to coincide, thankfully for me, with the characters. I loved the goodbye in the chase for Ian and Barbara because it's fucking left field, but it's earned with them and the story, and it's emotional and it's heartfelt.
And
And
Ian and Barbara's ending monologue as well, you know.
yeah.
Just like he want the simple comforts, you know. I want to be able to walk in a park and see a cricket match, or walk into a pub and have a pint of beer.
Yeah.
Like simple home comforts.
Yeah, so Darwin and Sarah's, it's ironic that like the leavings all come out of the blue. But they're not based on I fell in love with someone in this one story that I've known for 5 minutes. It's not based on death, thank God. And it's not she's here today, she's gone tomorrow, like Dodo and like Le Chat. Do you know what I mean? It's given a scene, it's given room to breathe, and I really liked it. So I was tracking about a 3 for the story as a whole. So not bad, but not fantastic. And then we got to that ending and that moved up to 3.5. So it's not quite out of 4 for me. I think there's a bit too much that I just don't that doesn't run in my brain. But it's a good story, 3, and that ending is so good. So brings it up to 3.5.
I have a quick question for you, because one other ending, despite the fact that it breaks my fucking balls that it happens, I still enjoy the emotional impact of it, is Zoe and Jamie's goodbye.
Yes, the reason why I didn't mention Zoe and Jamie is because their memories are wiped at the end of it.
And that's why I said it breaks my fucking heart,
Yeah.
every conceivable part of me,
Yeah,
because
but
like.
like, I mean, their one I think was done very well. Because I also think Susan's was done very well in many ways, except that she only met the guy that in that story, but the actual goodbye was very good. But I think in terms of a build up over the course of a story, this was the best one. And in terms of an earned one, this is one of the best in terms of being earned. And I would say, in terms of like, because like I said, with Sarah Jane, it came out of nowhere. With Ian and Barbara, it came out of nowhere. As in, it's just at the end of the story, this is presented to them. With this, like, it was built up over the story. And so, for the build up over the story exits, I think this is the best one that we've had so far.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. I think it's it well told, well earned, and it's a good one.
Yeah.
It suits the character.
I have a funny feeling. So, we'll be doing our rambling next week. So, we won't be doing the next episode next week. We'll be doing our rambling next week. And then we'll come back the following week to continue. I may have to watch this episode again with the audio commentary on. It's because the way this week has wound up, I didn't get to watch it. I didn't get to watch it because I have the Blu-ray. I didn't get to watch the special features. I may have to, in preparing for the rambling next week, go back and at least skim watch this to watch the important Nissa scenes to see what they're saying in the audio commentary. And I'm guessing, because they usually do, I'm guessing there's a goodbye Nissa featurette on the Blu-ray, which might give more insight into why the character was written out.
But so until next week, guys, when we do our Nissa rambling, thank you very much for listening, and bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.